welcome to episode 82 of Ladies of Scumption, Damage Control. And I think that is a title that I have not used before, so I'm going to roll with it. Here's episode 82. My name is Jessica, and I'm here with...
May.
Tatiana.
We are the Ladies of Scumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. You can contact us on Twitter at DCTVGumption, by email, ladieswithgumption@gmail.com. You can send us an ask on Tumblr, Ladies of Gumption. You can listen to our episodes on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and we are still uploading to Facebook. With our Patreon, you can contribute to us at patreon.com/DCTV Gumption, or you can hit our Redbubble store. The link is on our Podomatic page. You'll look at some of our shirt designs, which we will continue to update throughout the summer. And then also with our Patreon, we're working on our tiers, so we're going to introduce some new tier levels for you guys to see, like, if you contribute some money, what you would get from it. For example, if you wanted us to talk about the Avengers, or if you wanted to suggest some things for us to talk about, or Game of Thrones, or anything like that. So we'll work on that, and we'll get back to you when that is up. News. Not a lot of news. It's a slow news day at the office. But we do know that the man that was cast to play Abracadabra in The Flash is a, like, Damien Dumbmastichain or something.
Yes.
Yes. I probably did not pronounce it correctly. Him. He has also been cast to play Polka Dot Man in The Suicide Squad. He's keeping it within the DCTV family for now. And then also we learned that Batwoman has been picked up by the CW for a serious order. Shot. Keeping it within the Flash family for a second, Juliana Nera, who was one of the writers for The Flash, has announced that 521 is her last episode. This upcoming episode will be her last, and she's off to Streamier Pastures, which means that she's going to Netflix.
Yes. Oh, I think it's an Amazon show, but yeah.
Yeah.
And those of you who think that the evil has been defeated, and that, like, you're, like, a pro Snowberry, pro Caitlyn, Danielle, bestie has departed the show. My response to you would be, is that crack? Is that what you smoke? Is it crack?
You're
gonna like that. It's not.
Because, one, they hate her. Because she's, like, she has been, like, pro West Allen, pro Iris for such a long time. She's written, like, a lot of, like, West Allen heavy and Iris heavy episodes. So, I'm not really sure when it flipped that she just loves Caitlyn and hates Iris or something. I don't know. I don't know how that happened.
I honestly think it's because of that time that she said she liked the friendship.
In the very first season of her writing for the show.
Yeah.
And she said she liked the friendship. But then after that, she was like pro-heavy Iris Fallon for like ever.
It's funny because she gave us some of the best. Some of, like, the most memorable West Allen scenes. Like, she wrote 3-9, and they moved in together, and then 3-21.
Yeah, and 3-21. Yeah.
I can't remember what she wrote in season 4, but I'm sure there was some goodness from there, too.
She wrote 403, I think, with the wedding. the attempted wedding. yeah. But yeah, I mean, she's written good stuff. And also, she, first off, has no power. She's literally, like, for a very long time, she never got a producer credit, but for a very long time, she was the only writer on the staff without any kind of producer credit. So to try to blame her for, like, larger story things, or even just, like, the final draft of an episode, is, like, a bit much.
Yeah, it goes back to, like, individual writers versus, like, the Hollywood machine,
yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Right. 518.
Is that like where? Or no, she wrote like
one
heavy episode, and then that was it for her career.
It was like three. Well, she wrote 307. She didn't even write 307. She had the story idea for 307, but it was actually written by Andrew Kreisberg. So yeah. So basically, not that I'm saying like, oh no, it's a horrible loss, and like things will be worse now, because maybe things will be better. Maybe we'll find. Maybe Eric. Yeah, you know, while we're actually doing a sweep and is actually going to bring us some Black women in the writer's room, maybe, I don't know. But it's not like things are going to be much better just because she's gone. She did write 518, and she wrote 511 and 502. And I thought 502 was really good.
And next episode seems really West Allen family heavy too. So
yeah. Well, I will say she wrote Harry and the Harrisons 421, which is the one where Iris came back with, you know, the article. And 409, which is when Barry gets arrested. That was also a good episode. I'm just saying. She's not a bad writer.
And Jitalina Defense Squad.
It's just me. You're welcome for that. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
So moving into feedback, we had Swara send us a DM on Twitter, and he just said, "Hey ladies, I'm happy to report that I really enjoyed this week's Supergirl, Kara's in her element as a journalist, Nia getting to truly shine, Lena coming clean to her best friend Kara, and his nitpick is that Kara should have told Lena her own truth right there, and so much more made this a wonderful and uplifting episode. I really just could do without Lockwood and get back to Lex. I just do not care if this virulent white supremacist pain or his hardline bigoted wife dying. The number one critique I have of this season is the Children of Liberty storyline. On that note, Kara interviewing Nia to push back against hate was exactly what they should have had her do earlier in the season. While I loved it, it also came too late, as it was the common sense thing to do from the beginning. Anyway, can't wait to hear y'all's thoughts on the podcast."
Yay, Swara, whom I met last weekend, and is very, very kind.
Aww, was he everything you dreamed of?
Well, did she dream of him in the first place?
He was everything I thought he would be based on my online impression of him.
So, following up with the Supergirl feedback, we have Shang, who just says that he was expecting Lena to be emotional over James, but didn't see the stuff with Kara or Brainy coming. But I actually really liked the talk that Brainy gave her. Weirdly, this episode has given me hope that Lena and Kara will eventually be okay after the reveal. Maybe not right away, but Lena forgiving Kara, knowing deep down, understanding the fear of knowing a secret that could destroy a relationship. Also, Shang at Kara every time he sees Lena opens up to her, and it's a gift of Genie from Aladdin just saying, "Tell her the truth," which is how we all feel. Nia, my child, her speech, I will die for her. The writer's only mode while adding backstories, intense childhood trauma. So everyone has intense childhood trauma. Lena has childhood trauma. James has childhood trauma. Honestly, the thought this episode could not get any more emotional. James's mind palace was so heavy, and I was actually glad the commercial break so he could breathe. And then for Legends, he says he hopes that Drogon hatches out of the egg. If Lady with Gumption Choice nominee is actually Lady Lyanna of House Mormont, which I will accept.
Yes. This is true. And perhaps, in a tier, we could talk about that.
Yes. So thank you, Shang, and thank you, Swara. Now, moving into Flash feedback, we have Paulina. And there's going to be a lot of pauses in here because I'm going to be, like, scrolling to find, like, key points, so... Paulina says, so while we're down to the final two episodes after Tuesday Night Flash, she's going to break from her traditional method of giving feedback on most aspects of the episode to talk about something that has really bothered her the whole season. It made it hard for her to really enjoy Gone Rogue fully, even though theoretically it's an episode that had all the elements that I enjoy. Barry and Iris looking together to find Nora, and Joseph going to Steel, assisting with where they need be. It actually had Cisco proving once again that the show really isn't at its best self without Cisco's one-liners. And yes, it was filler, but I honestly rather watch Weather Witch and Bug-Eyed Bandit, both of whom I dislike, than Grace Kata. And I do like Ragdoll independently. So overall, it was a good episode, and there were aspects of love, but I just cannot stand for the continued disrespect of Iris West Allen. When Iris and Cecile had the conversation where Cecile coaxes Iris to open up about how she's been thinking about why Nora didn't come back to her, even if Barry was being bullheaded to put the plan to defeat Grace Kata in motion and why she turned to the Young Rogues instead. I almost thought Iris was going to say, "I'm not enough," because that's how the conversation seemed to be going, but she just left with, Nora must really have had a good reason for going to team up with the Young Rogues. This angered me because I wanted Iris to say it and actually be emotionally devastated by it, because the writers clearly have been driving that point home. No matter what she does, no matter how much she showers Nora with love and trust and respect, she's not enough for Nora. It's painful and awful, but what's even more awful is that the writers are too cowardly to admit that's essentially what they've written, hence why that conversation took the detour that it did. That's interesting. I can see where she's going with that. And basically, in this episode, Iris is right. Iris is always right. Nora did have a plan. She was going to retrieve the specific guns from destroy Grace Tater's dagger. Iris is right. Iris is always right. Anyways.
It's true.
Yeah. And she's like, and this is the best part. Hashtag sarcasm. Bartholomew himself turns around at the end of the episode and says, yes, I may not like where the plan comes from, but it's a good plan. Let's use it. Iris is a sweetheart because if I were her, I would have literally fixated him with such a glare. Instead, she goes, are you sure, Bear? And hey, Flash Riders, maybe now's a good time to have Barry, at the very least, acknowledge that his wife was being sensible and had the foresight to see exactly what was happening while he was raising his voice and being all like, I thought we were past this. But nah. That would be giving Iris far too much credit, even though she was literally spot on right. Look, Helena, they've been doing this since at least season 3, when Iris has come up with stuff, and Barry had, like, light bulb moments, and then he goes back to Team Flash, and he's like, guess what I figured out? He knows it was not him. So this is something they've been doing for, like, a while.
But Iris also had one of those moments that she's like, we'll never leave you again, but that's in the dislike second.
At the end of the day, I'm skipping down the past a lot of this, and of course, like, the whole thing will go up on Tumblr so you can see the full scope of calling your thoughts, but she's saying that at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if Nora will be erased, and if we get twins, so that the writers can say do-over, because they screwed up the first time, and they don't get to say do-over when they've disrespected Iris' motherhood every step of the way the first time. Damage is done. If Dawn and Dawn do tell Iris they love her every single day, and that she's the best mom in the world, great. But that doesn't negate how horribly writers have disrespected Iris' motherhood the first time around. And she reiterates one last time, shouldn't Barry and Nora have acknowledged at the end that it was Iris who held them together, who made sure they would come back together and that their father-daughter relationship is stronger? Anyways, I did like this episode, but I cannot shake this, so it dimmed my enjoyment of the episode considerably. I did really like the two parallel father-daughter team-ups at the end, Barry and Nora in Flash Time, and of course Iris and Joe taking down Ragdoll. Iris' right hook is the stuff of legends. That is my OCD, Paulina. Iris and her right hook. I asked Patsy to make a gift set of that for me.
That I still got made, but I will make.
That's on record. She said she will make it. Okay, thanks, Paulina. Moving on to Mara with her flash feedback. She says, hello, ladies. How are you doing? I hope you've been having a good week so far. Thank you, Mara. There's definitely quite a bit to like in Gone Rogue, but there are so many better directions this episode could have taken. The writers are essentially building a contrived plot to bring Eobard Thawne back into the fray, and thus they treat their characters, most visibly Nora, as plot devices to maneuver their chess pieces to the way they want. Case in point, I've been thinking back to the nominated ladies with gumption this past television season, and while I didn't keep track, I wish I had, so do we! Because we can't keep track either. She says, I don't think Nora was nominated after 501. Maybe she was nominated for 507, but I can't be sure. For season 8. What now?
I don't think she was.
For 507? I don't think she was either.
I think she's been the least nominated this season, or one of the least nominated this season, considering like how much story she's done.
Right, and that's what Mara was saying. For a season based around Barry and Iris' kid, Nora should have had a lot more agency and a personality outside of ultra impulsive working with Dawn and misses her dad more than anything in the world. Even with her abandonment issues when it comes to her dad, which were on full display in this episode, they haven't been properly fleshed out. Nora literally exists to service a particular narrative the writers want to tell. Nora's continued dismissal of Iris is beyond annoying, but it's symptomatic of Nora being a plot device. Her relationship with Barry is integral to Dawn's betrayal of her hitting as hard as it will, because Thawne's been helping her to go back to see her father. And that's why we see her being all, Dad abandoned me! Dad left me! I know Mom came back, but who cares? It's Dad!
Yeah, that's very insightful.
That's what she said. Nora doesn't have fleshed out feelings outside of that, and the writers don't value Iris' mother to write all that. They think they dusted their hands after 512 because Iris and Nora don't serve the greater narrative purpose in the way that Barry and Nora does.
True.
So this then begs the question, why have Iris adamantly defend Nora the way she does? I'm thinking two things. One, the only consistent thing about this season has been Iris' love for Nora and her taking into motherhood beautifully. Two, Iris genuinely believes that Thorne cares for Nora and wants to do right for her, and that therefore she trusts Nora's judgment about this serves the greater narrative purpose. Yet again, namely that it leads into Iris and Barry, and now that he wants to go through with a plan orchestrated by Thorne, being duped by Thorne. That is exactly what is going to happen. It will hit harder when Thorne's going to be running amok in the current timeline and her future kid's been erased from existence, and Barry's disappearing a lot earlier. If Iris and Barry think they're partly to blame for all of this because they were naive enough to trust Nora's judgment, who is actually extremely naive, even if Thorne's plan to defeat Grace does work, and I think it will. It's just positioning the characters in a way so the narrative can hit the key notes that it wants to. OCC behavior be damned. That's why I generally don't care about the brief back and forth between Barry and Iris in this episode or the resolution of it, even though I do think Iris got the short end of the stick in this episode because she got zero credit for being the one person to bring Nora and Barry back together. I think that is an excellent take and is extremely accurate.
I agree.
That's what's going to happen.
Yep.
She does have some predictions, which should I read a few of them now? I feel like I'm going to, like, someone remind me to go back to this when we get to the last one.
Okay. Yeah, because I won't, you know, I don't do predictions no more. I'm done with them.
Cheyenne sent us her flash feedback.
I was going to say Tati's been burned too many times by predicting.
Cheyenne says that she hopes this week finds us doing well. Thanks, Cheyenne. I enjoyed your podcast from last week. You ladies had some great perspectives on the last episode. I keep wishing that I had watched other Arrowverse shows so I can interact with you about those shows as well, but sadly, Flash is all we have in common for now. Episode was all things filler, some great West Allen and West scenes, but outside of that, the episode was okay. I guess it's the best way to describe it. It won't be on my list of favorites, that's for sure. What she liked. She says, I liked the hallway scene between Barry and Iris, where they once again discuss all things that is Nora. We are finally being shown a lot more Barry and Iris providing a perspective on what's going on. Besides that, I love their scenes together in period, especially when they're given good material to work with. She likes the scene of Barry and Nora at Stark Eyes when we got to see Nora express her anger towards Barry for what he did to her. She said some truths during that speech that I believe Barry needed to hear. He hurt her and she let him know that he did. Enjoyed Iris and Joe's team up against Ragdoll. Love seeing badass Iris. Sign me up for that all day, every day. Barry and Joe's talking in the lab about Robin Hood was great to see. Loved Iris and Cecile scene in Iris' office. We don't get to see that too much, if at all, this season. Would love to see more of the two of these ladies having scenes together in the future. Did not like the villains of the week. She didn't care. Of all the villains they bring back, they brought back the Bee Lady.
She was awesome. Leave her alone.
She was better this episode than her.
Yeah, yeah. Way better than she was the first time.
I was worried about her presence. But I was surprised.
Yeah. Thought the Nora high storyline was just weird, and Nora Negus speed force. I thought there would be more consequence for her using that. There could be, Cheyenne. The episode 21 is called The Girl with the Red Lightning, so there could be more consequences later on. She's on the fence about Sherlock and Cisco storyline. Some parts are cute, some are not. Caitlin Ralph's storyline was meh. I almost forgot they had scenes together. She almost barfed when it looked like they were attempting to put Ralph and Caitlin together. Thank God Ralph saved the day with that line, but other than that, it was a mess. Overall, it wasn't the greatest episode, but it wasn't the worst. I'm trying this new thing with ending on a positive note. That's the best that she can do. Excited as to how they're going to end the season. We know Reverse Flash will make an appearance. We saw Craig Grace and Kata, too, at the end of the episode, so I'm guessing next episode will be about her plan and defeating her. Seems like a lot is left to do. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. And you will, Cheyenne, you will, right after this commercial break. With our last feedback of this week is from Anita Vacation, which is hilarious. And it's actually kind of funny because I am on vacation right now. I'm in Hawaii. So yay me. But Anita,
lovely,
yay, says that I exaggerate not when I tell you that I scream at the sight of Cisco and Sneak Peeks and Gone Rogue. You bring such a range of talent and continuity to the show, and we already lost much of our comfort during Papa Joe's absence. Underusing him in season 5 was a crime, with Cisco cracking wise at Crazy B-Girl and mocking Nora for joining a rogue cover band. That is a Cisco we need more of and not less. So I was shaking my head at Barry and Iris' child until she reversed double crossed the road. I sincerely hope that we find out Tio Cisco was in Honora's con game, because it was not alright that she glowed her eyes red and raised the vibrating hand at him. Mm-hmm. Nora, how could you, knowing that Fallon really did that to Cisco? Which is a good point. Iris and Barry's argument in the hallway was clumsily worded on Iris' part. I'm sure that she does empathize with Barry about mistrusting Eobard Thawne, but it came across like she was naively going along, thinking anyone can be redeemed. And knowing Barry, he probably imagines Thawne binge watching Thrones with Iris and helping Norris with her speech forces. That's probably exactly what he's thinking. Like, she's like, I trust Thawne. She's like, well, you know, now he's like moving in and being like the second dad to.
Oh, geez.
That's probably everything that's like flashed through his head. Like, why don't you just go marry Thawne then, you know?
He did give her advice, like, Barry's like, what's next?
The fact that she said that, she was like, he's the one that told me to come back and work things out with you. What would you have done otherwise, Iris?
Yeah,
right?
That was so worded.
Oh my gosh. I hate this.
Okay,
so Anita asked, is just one more thing, is it too early for season 6 wish list? Because I now need the powers to be to take a firm hand and fix whatever bad juju is happening between Caitlin Snow and Iris with Alan. In the morning briefing scene at Star Labs, Iris could barely sustain a glance at Caitlin, much less address her, even during the part when Barry offered Caitlin bereavement time off. I'm dying to know how Iris, a no-nonsense black woman, really feels about that ice monster, that willing accessory to her near murder, working at Star Labs, treating her like a child, treating her child and in home with her husband. What were the writers even smoking when Eobard Isak killed again Fawn, gave Iris effective relationship advice and family advice, and her own maid of honor was nowhere to be found in this season issue all season long? Listen. It's not going to happen. That ship has sailed. She was a maid of honor for, like, speaking of plot devices, that was a whole-ass plot device before.
Tragic.
Just, you know, it's not going to happen. You're not going to get, like, the answer that you want with this. So, you know, the like, hope for Iris and Caitlin's friendship fell, like, right in the middle of season 2. Like, when season 2 shut off, I was like, no, this is not going to happen. It's never going to happen. So, I mean, if that's what your wish list is for, go to AO3 fanfiction.
I mean, if it makes anyone feel better, Iris has interacted the most with women in general this entire season, so there's that.
That is true. That is true.
It's just that Caitlin will never be one of them.
Working with Camille off screen. She has a whole child.
Has a whole child, girl. Yeah. So there are other ways of female friendships, other avenues.
Who's probably going to come in season 6 and swoop in and maybe save the BFF day.
Yes!
And then she'll be like the best friend that we wish that Iris has had forever. So it'll be alright. Anyways, so thank you guys for all the feedback. For the parts of your feedback that I skipped, it'll be in full on Tumblr, so everybody can go and read up on that, comment, like, reblog, do whatever you would like to do. So, moving into the actual episode at hand, the format is Supergirl and Arrow on side A, The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, and Doom Patrol on side B, likes, dislikes, and Lady Assumption of the Week. Our host this week is Tati. She's going to take it away on side A, Water Cooler Memory / Relative Truth. Take it away, Tati.
I will do my best to take it away. So, here we go. We start off with Supergirl, as usual, in American Dreamer, as Kara doggedly works as a reporter to clear Supergirl's name, Dreamer picks up the slack as National City's protector, leading to a showdown with Ben Lockwood. Meanwhile, James takes drastic measures to relieve his PTSD, and David Harewood directed the episode, as well as had one random scene at the end that I previously forgot about. Story by Dana Horgan, and teleplay by Daniel Beatty and Jeff Carnos. So, what do we like about... That was this one, right? That was this episode where he had the random scene at the end?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was like, did that happen last week or did that happen this week?
It makes sense. So
yeah, exactly. Now that I know that he's directing, I'm like, that's why. But what did we like about the episode? Please enlighten me.
I love the exploration of James's trauma and how Brainy and Co. were working on pinpointing the main cause of his distress so that they can target it and have James be in control of his powers. And all his minds, all the mind stuff going on in the Arrowverse this year is great, so I love that for me. This entire subplot was especially interesting because James had never before brought up his family until after Kelly came to visit, and I think this was a key component to understanding him better than the show has ever allowed us to since the very beginning. And I also really liked how much Kelly was a part of this subplot. Like, she wasn't just playing the supportive sister, but you could tell that the specific memory also triggered her and her own negative feelings about past events, and also how it explains her and James' strained relationship up to this point. And I like that they both benefited from the trip to the Mind Palace. And speaking of the Mind Palace, seeing James' memories of his dad was devastating, but I really liked that James got to work through his complicated emotions behind the reasons for missing his dad's funeral, and that they did it by linking his false/repressed memories of the event together with it was even better. And then Alex being there for Kelly, the way Kelly's been there for her, was really beautiful, as was the moment Kelly went into James's memories to be there for him. I think they took a major step forward in terms of their sibling relationship, which was really, really great. And then Kara investigating was surprising, but not really, since after last episode we knew she was going to do that, but it's just a nice, you know, refreshing thing for the show. I think all of the Arrowverse shows tend to get so caught up with superhero aspect that they forget these heroes also have lives outside of that. So I'm actually grateful that Kara got to do her job, even if it came at the expense of Supergirl being grounded right now, which is all right. She showed, like, the power of journalism by asking Mia to take part in the interview and go public with her identity as Dreamer. Even though it took 19 episodes to finally showcase an alien to the public, no, Kara's column doesn't count because it was only, like, mentioned once or twice in the first half of the season. But now that they've finally done it, I think they did a really good job. It was thoughtful and powerful, and Mia was really brave, and I liked it a lot that she pointed out she wasn't just half alien and half human, but also transgender. And her line about when did being different become a bad thing was really impactful. I did tear up. It was a very emotional moment. And also her saying she loved nerdy boys who think too much, and Brainy followed that up by asking what love feels like, makes me ship them again because I'm weak. And then finally, Kara really being there for Lena after being called out for being a bad friend was really nice, because she has been a bad friend. I think we haven't really seen them interact very deeply since, like, the end of season 2, and I'm glad she admitted she was and then made an effort to be there for Lena now. And then Lena was also on an honesty streak and got to be open and vulnerable when talking about working with Lex. So I'm really glad that we finally got a solid friendship bonding scene between them after, like, 84 years.
Aw. I do love her return to Journalist Kara and the whole back to basics concept. It feels like she's been leaning way too much into the Supergirl persona. She's got using Supergirl as a crutch. So it's nice to see her touch base with what it felt like to make a difference without superpowers. And I guess I don't know if she's ever had, I guess a couple times when it was convenient over the course of the seasons, but she really started into the heroics as Supergirl and not as reporter Kara, because that came later. So I don't know if that was, maybe that's part of the reason why she just kind of, like, leaned heavily into Supergirl over reporter Kara. So it was nice to kind of have that, you know, Supergirl kind of stripped away from her for a bit so she could see what it feels like to make a difference without superpowers. Or without the Supergirl persona, because she can't use it. I also like that the absence of Supergirl allowed space for Dreamer to make a name for herself. And Mia has really stepped up in such a short period of time and has really grown comfortable with using her powers, and she's not afraid to use them. Which you can see, like, even before she became Dreamer, when she specifically went to stop the guys at the pizza place from harassing Brainy, you know, that she's always had that in her. And now with Supergirl out, there's this vacuum of a superhero, and Mia stepped in as Dreamer to fill that void. So that was really nice. Gives her space to do a lot of the work and get some well-deserved credit of her own. I liked the interview that she did with Kara, specifically because she was able to connect in such a human way, and not just the child of an alien mother and a human father, but also as a trans woman. So she's kind of connecting on two different levels. She's the bridge between aliens and humans, being the daughter of both, and also another bridge, being a trans woman and just regular American society and kind of the issues that come with that, and it was just a really, like, powerful speech. And, like, the rational part of me is concerned about Nia revealing too much of herself. Like, the fact that she's a trans woman and she likes her Disney Aprils and, like, all of her background and et cetera. But narratively, I think it spoke on many levels as to what the quote-unquote American dream should be, and her opening up about herself and all the kind of little mundane things that she likes, and just makes her seem very, like, approachable and just open and honest. And I thought it was, the interview was very powerful and very inspirational and very beautiful. And then Rainey's, and then, like, the shots of everybody, like, watching her speech and being affected by it, especially Rainey's, like, what does love feel like while watching the interview? It may be the first time that I actually, like, relationship Rainey rather than just friendship.
Yeah, you finally step over to the light side.
For now. For this, like, one specific moment. I mean, because I feel like, because I've started to relationship it, it makes me go into, like, the worst possible case scenario, which is in my predictions. But for now, I think, like, this is just the first time I felt, like, a real genuine push in that direction. Not just, like, a funny, comedic, will they, won't they, let's use this for comedy kind of thing. But it just felt very genuine with Nia being so vulnerable. For then to see Brainy be vulnerable as well and ask about love and everything like that, seems like a really genuine push for the ship rather than just this could be funny kind of thing. I also really appreciated James' storyline and the continued introspection into PTSD and what it means to be healed. I like how Alex continues to show up for Kelly, primarily under the context of being a support for her and James. Although eventually I would like for their relationship, Kelly and Alex's relationship, to move outside of James. I do like that Alex's offered to be there for both of them. James's trauma being tied to his father's funeral and him not being able to attend due to bullies trapping him was really, like, emotional for me. And it feels like so much of his and Kelly's relationship is due to a misunderstanding of what happened that day and the fact that their dad's funeral played such a vital role in how James approaches life and his decision making. I hope Kelly learning about the truth and about that night leads to a closer relationship with her brother and that she stays in Nashville City longer. I also really enjoyed episodes. Yeah. The past two or so episodes have been all about Lena and Supergirl, but it was nice this week to see Kara and Lena reconnect. So, like, the original friendship kind of reconnects as well. Because we already kind of, it was kind of more explicit that Supergirl and Lena had a falling out, and a little bit kind of under the radar that Kara and Lena also weren't doing so great. So I like that first they fixed Lena and Supergirl, and now they're fixing Lena and Kara. I like that Kara apologized for not being around with the whole Lex thing that was going on. And when she told Lena that, you know, friendship is the most important job, I thought that was cute. The fight in Catco, this is like a little small one, but the fight in Catco where they turn off the lights and Kara just pretended like Franklin saved her. Like, Franklin, you saved me! That was also really cute. And I liked that one. That's it.
That is cute. I loved everyone working together to help James, like Brainy, Lena, Alex, Kelly, like it. It helped, like, James finally feels like he's, like, an active part of the narrative now. And, like, we see how important he is to plenty of people, unlike in previous seasons where he was just, like, off with Wynn somewhere in the background and or was Superman's best friend, but Superman did not ever stop by to talk to him whenever he came to town. So, yeah, I like that he's a little bit more centered now. And I also like how they explicitly acknowledge the connection between his powers and his PTSD. Like, it's not like they're not saying, like, oh, it wasn't PTSD, it's your powers, good job, moving on. They know they have to deal with his trauma and access it in order to be able to move forward with his powers. It was also a nice callback to how we were first introduced to Brainy when he entered Kara's mind, so seeing him do that again with James was nice. And I also thought it was really interesting that he was the one who realized that James was suppressing a memory from his childhood. He was like, oh, I think that you just told yourself this bathroom story so long that you believed it, you know? Maybe it's because he was already in his brain, so he knew that there was something fishy there, but it also, you know, it's like Brainy understands more about human emotions than he thinks he does. Yay! I thought the suppression was a good way of showcasing the psychological burdens you know, that James has about, like, his own strengths, right? About his role as a man, as a hero, and also a great starting point to understand his strained relationship with Kelly. I really liked seeing her step into her brother's memories and then discovering the true cause of his disappearance from the funeral with him, right? Seeing them both together in that memory and her finally being able to understand James's pain and also hearing herself in the memory was good. I loved Nia this week. She was so awesome. Seeing her step to the plate, be so enthusiastic about helping people, being so comfortable in her own skin and her powers. Loved American Woman playing while she was kicking ass. It's very cheesy, I know, but I enjoyed it. Just like I enjoyed the I'm Just a Girl way in Captain Marvel. But a lot of people were like, that was too much. I'm like, no, that's just correct. We should do more of this. Anyway, it made sense to me that she felt down because no matter how many bad guys she stops, she can't change the conditions that aliens are living in, you know, the fear and helplessness that they are going to continuously feel until the country actually changes. So I really like that.
Bad guys are the government. Like, that's, like, a huge thing.
Yeah.
Like, bad guys are, like, the authority, so how do you even combat that?
Right. So I like that she and Kara took that next step, you know, using journalism, using the media as a way to connect with people. And as much as I don't buy that Kara has autonomous publishing powers, I don't think she can just take over the airwaves in order to have an impromptu interview with Nia. I do love that they did it, and I love what Nia said. Her responses appealed to the humanity of others by commenting on her own, right? So I really liked that. It was really personal and very adorable. And of course, I loved her saying, I like nerdy boys who think too much, which in turn stirred that whole what does love feel like realization in Brainy. It was super cute. I've obviously been on board with the ship from the start, so I'm glad that it's finally, like, seemed like more than just a weird joke that the writers keep bringing up. So, like, we'll see. We'll see what they do with it. But I also love that it didn't just inspire him to potentially feel love, but it also inspired him to fight alongside her, to actually be brave enough to go fight at Kako. And be part of the fray, despite the 63.6% chance of being apprehended. And also, when James joined, then I was, like, really cheering in my seat, right? I was like, oh my god, it's when everyone's together! So yeah, I really love that. I love Lena and Kara being friends again. I'm glad that we got real acknowledgement that Kara has been missing as Lena's friend. You know, we've all seen it, and yet the show was not seeing it. And now they acknowledge it. So I'd like to thank not only God, but also Jesus. also, Kara having photos taped to her window and notes scrawled all around them. A win for journalism. I also liked how they kind of showed the impact that Nia had by first having Kara try to reach out, you know, to Edna through Franklin. And that girl being too scared until she felt inspired by Nia. And then she actually provided some of that information. So I liked that too. What did we not like about this episode?
I did think it was really weird that Lena and James didn't share a one-on-one scene. Ever. At all. I know they're broken up right now. But considering everything that James is going through and that Lena was involved in helping to bring him back from the brink of death and involved in even making a cure to begin with, it would have been nice for them to share a scene about everything that was happening. So I thought that was, like, underwhelming. It's like the writers have forgotten they were even a couple, which is strange, but, you know, I'm not really surprised. And then I'm mad Lockwood's wife died because now that's just going to be more ammo for Ben to use, and George isn't going to be too happy about that either, right when he had a come-to-Jesus moment. Speaking of George, it was frustrating that he only stopped what he was doing because he found out his friend was an alien, so that just fueled the fire behind the idea that anyone different isn't really human, but if they have the stamp of approval from the bigots, then it's fine.
Yeah, we're not mad that George's mom died. We're mad that of the man pain that's going to come from George's mom's time. And that's, like, the same thing. I didn't like that. I think I liked the majority of this episode. There are a lot of good elements in the two biggest plot stories is with Kara and Nia, and then with James as well. But the whole Children of Liberty, Lockwood family aspect of it all, I thought it was just, like, ridiculous that George is only realizing that aliens are people too after coming face-to-face with a friend that happens to be an alien. It's a little, like, I have a black friend kind of cringeworthy. Like, oh my god, my my black friend is a person, so that must mean all black people are people. That's kind of how it felt like to me. Like, why do oppressors need, like, a quote-unquote alien best friend to see, like, the humanity of people? Why can't you just, like, see it because it exists? So, like, why do you need to have, like, some emotional connection to it for it to be the truth in your mind? So I thought that was a little ridiculous. And then I also don't care about Lockwood's wife dying because it just means that Gracie's Jr. won't actually change now because his mom's been murdered. So all in all, like, if you're going to do the whole cringeworthy, oh my god, my best friend is an alien, so maybe I shouldn't hate all aliens because I know one. And then, like, him seeing me, I'd be like, oh my god, aliens are people too. And she's alien and human. Wow, we can live together. Oh my god, my mom died. She was killed by an alien. So I was like, what was the point of the whole thing of him realizing aliens are could be good people, and then you, like, murder his mom, and so it's like, shit, but I guess they're not good people. So, like, what was, there was no growth. It's just, like, one big clusterfuck of, you know, realization and then backtracking all in the same episode. So I don't understand why they did it in the first place. So it's just kind of dumb, the end.
Last time you said it was a pile of shit. I didn't like that the woman who murdered Lydia was the one whose husband was arrested at the start of the episode, because I felt like it was like, oh, look, you know, again, like, George first started feeling bad. He's like, oh, I feel so bad for that lady. And then later he'd be like, oh, see, I didn't have to because she's actually awful. And it makes it feel like it's reinforcing what Dad Lockwood said when he was like, they're roaches, you know, they're not human. So whatever, I didn't like that. I also feel like it furthers, like, the accidental narrative that, like, the only sane aliens, and only sane humans for that matter, are the main characters. Everyone else is crazy, right? No matter what. Also, I don't like that Lydia got murdered at all, because it's fodder for Ben and now George's man thing. Like, obviously I despise Lydia and I think she's just as bad as her husband, but women in refrigerators remains a very dumb plot device. Could just go up. I mean, we already killed his granddad.
Just kill George.
Right, I was about to say, kill George. I was like, well, we already killed his granddad. Can we kill son too? Yes, we can. But anyway, I don't know why that was needed. Like, it's not like Lockwood was gonna stop. And what is George gonna do? Lead his own little racist army? Like, whatever. Whatever. It's stupid. Okay, moving on. Speaking of terrible plot devices, as Jess already pointed out, the I have an alien friend is not a good way to showcase a bigot transforming into an understanding human being. Could have been, you know, he could have just seen that lady suffering over her husband and felt bad for her. And then, because he related it to his mother's experience, right, when his dad was taken away. And then just not have his mother die. And then see what happens when Lockwood has to deal with someone in his own family that's not a psycho. Done! But no, we didn't do that. Yeah, and as much as I liked the James and Kelly plot, I thought the imagine Thanos snapping them out of existence moment was, like, a little bit silly. And I was like, alright, let's just push them out of your mind. I was like, I know you have to do it in some way, like, that's the way they chose to do it, and that's fine. But I was like, alright, okay. Also, I would have liked a moment between Lena and James. So we can know if we're, like, done for good with that relationship, or if we're going to be moving forward with it, because now the reason why she broke up with him in the first place has been removed. So, like, what are we doing? and I would like Kelly and Alex to have a conversation that is not about James or Haley. I think it's time for them to get to know each other.
Get all the people out of the way. Just have Kelly. Yeah. Like, go out. Like, we've been through a lot, Alex. Let's go out for ice cream or something.
Right. So, any predictions, ladies?
Well, now that I am on board Rania, I am predicting that it will implode.
We're taking that when you weren't on board.
She put her foot on the ship and then just backed out.
She was like, they're not going anywhere. Now that they're going somewhere, it's somewhere bad.
Because the whole issue between Brenny and Nia has been Brenny, like, dragging his foot on his feelings about Nia, and then also Nia, like, pressuring Brenny or, like, nagging Brenny to tell her about her descendant and Brenny not wanting to, And so that's like the whole Descendant thing has been like a thing coming up throughout this entire thing. So I think that Brienne will finally confess he's ready to take the plunge. Like, okay, I'm in this. Let's go. Only to like open himself up too far and reveal too much about Mira in the future. And me being like, whoa, okay, that's probably not worth the risk. So let's not do that. We shouldn't be together. So it's going to be like Nate and Maya 2.0. Of course she has to like protect her timeline and like not be together. And yeah, that's what I think is going to happen.
That's sad. I don't like that.
I feel like that.
I don't like it. Well, Jess is like already shaking her head. My hopeful self believes that Lena will finally, obviously she'll find out Kara is Supergirl before the end of the season, but she won't be as mad about it because she also lied about Lex. But, you know, that probably is too optimistic.
You bummer child. You poor little silly rabbit. Honestly, if Lena does not freak out over the fact that Kara is Supergirl, then I'm going to be upset because there's, like, we've had 3-4 seasons now where it's, like, build up to Kara finding out. So there needs to be, like, legit fallout. And be like, oh, that's okay. I have secrets, too.
There's no excuse for her not to have told Lena, so.
Yeah.
Like, I can even imagine her coming. What would be the excuse? There is none. Anyway. Right. So, yes, Lena better be mad about it. Okay. Moving on to Arrow. These are my confessions. These are my confessions. When they learn of an upcoming attack on the city, Team Arrow calls Roy Harper to help them stop the Ninth Circle. However, things go awry because Roy does not tell them the truth. And also, Team Arrow...
statement.
Has no accountability. And there's massive collateral damage. As captain of the SCPD, Dinah investigates what happens in an episode that takes on a true crime narrative and tone. Or really a fake crime narrative and tone, because there's nothing true about the crime. Tara Miel directed the episode, written by Annalee Hunter Hughes and Emilio Ortega Aldrich. What did we like about the episode?
Well, I think this is my new favorite episode of Arrow. I love the writing and the idea of, like, a whodunit mystery. And all of, like, the twists and turns and the different fake narratives between all of the Arrow cast members. I feel like the writer's room, especially with Arrow, has taken a lot of creative risks this season. And I feel like most of them have paid off. So I really like this season as a whole with all of the different styles of writing and styles of episodes that the writers have tried to do. This episode had me on my toes, changing sides, questioning what I knew from beginning to end. I was mad at some characters in the gang, and then like, oh my god, like that, what's that gif where the guy's just like, open mouth, like, oh, like I cannot believe this is happening right in front of my face, like right in front of my salad, people. So I was really like intrigued about like, what actually is the truth, like Oprah dot gif, what is the truth? One scene that I did think was really funny in context was, like, Felicity having all these pregnancy cravings while constantly, like ordering more food to eat until Dinah revoked her snack privileges. Like, that was enough for you, Missy. And I just thought it was funny because, on the one hand, Felicity's character, like, her personality just seems like she would just randomly, like, stress eat in these kind of situations. And so no one would think the wiser that, why is she ordering all this food? But seeing as how Dinah didn't know she was pregnant, and the fact that Dinah was actually in on the whole plot from the beginning, I wonder if she just thought that it was a weird acting choice on, like, Lizzie's part or whatever, like, that she didn't really know what was going on when she was going with it. So I thought that was a very clever way to include the fact that, by the way, remember, Lizzie is still pregnant, into the storyline without it being super obvious, because Dinah doesn't know. And then other than that, like, I don't really have, like, specific scenes that I like so much, because so much of it was based on lies and deception of all of the characters involved. And while I liked how the reveal unraveled, I have a big issue with the reveal itself. And that involves, like, everybody in the cast. But as far as, like, as a whole tone and overall concept of the episode and the writing of the episode, I loved it. The end.
I think it's funny that, like, you're like, my favorite episode, but then y'all wrote, like, 3 lines. But I
know. Well, yeah, but you create, like...
It's hard to, like, point out a specific line. All of the scenes are lying.
Yeah.
Like,
have been doing a great job to give us episodes that are formatted differently. Like, besides this episode, I really love the 150th episode. And in this particular one, I liked the concept of the whodunit mystery. It kind of felt like I was watching Clue with, I feel like it was also influenced by the Usual Suspects twist. Like, ha-ha! You know, this is who did it. And then how they managed to make it all play out was really well done. Like, each individual scene was where they would just really pause every time they got to the place where a character was standing over the guards, and I thought that was really clever. I actually had to pay a lot of attention to the episode because I was worried I would miss a big clue that would give away who murdered the guards every single time. So I would have never seen Roy coming. And what this episode really highlighted was the downfall of Arrow, the Team Arrow, and how the present is aligning with what happens in the future and how we got there. So their rule of protecting their own showcased, or will showcase to the city at least, how they still believe they're above the law, especially if it means covering up a crime that one of them committed, and that feeds directly into the city being anti-vigilante in the future. So I really like that. So this episode really felt like the straw that broke the camel's back because of all the events we know will happen, and it also had like a lot of suspense. I like the cinematography of it, like the color schemes, everything, the tone, and as well as every scene kind of ended on a cliffhanger, and then the episode itself ended on a cliffhanger. So I thought all of that was really well done.
Yay! I thought the episode was a prime example of the show's willingness to experiment this season. So good job on that front, Beth. You did well. It was full of tension. I totally believed Dinah did not know what was going on, so I was totally, you know, in on that side of things until Minnie spoiled it for me. I also believed, you know, like, that Oliver didn't want to, like, give up his sister, right? He did a good job. I was like, why is he being so dramatic about this? Like, his sister's already a crazy axe murderer, so I'm not sure why he's like, I don't want to say that she killed these two men. And obviously that's because it was part of fake. It was fake. That's why. But anyway, so that was good. It had me wondering what really happened throughout. I also liked they set it up in media res, and then they went back and told the story through flashbacks where the focus really was the murder mystery and not the actual act of stopping the Night Circle's latest terror attack, because it's like they knew, I just don't care about that. I don't care about the Night Circle. I don't care what they're going to do next. So this was a more interesting way of approaching it. Also, I thought I liked seeing Roy back. So that was a nice little reunion. It was nice to hear that Thea was doing well, that they hadn't broken up, that she wasn't randomly dead, etc. All of this made me happy. I also thought his stunt double was great. Lots of those fight sequences I really liked. Felicity's food cravings. That was a really funny scene, as you brought up, Jess. And also the one where she was like, there's no reason why I would be overly emotional. My hormones are totally in check. Like, that was really cute. I enjoyed that. And also how Roy was just like, okay, moving on. I liked the scene where Oliver was talking things through with Roy and figured out that it was a Lazarus pit situation. And, you know, it's very hypocritical of Thea to put Roy in a Lazarus pit when their entire project was destroying Lazarus pits, but also very on brand because she loves Roy and she's not going to let him die. So I liked all of that. Even though it wasn't actually part of the episode, I could imagine it with my mind's eye, and I appreciate it. Anyway, I also like that we're seeing how Team Arrow are the architects of their own destruction and Star Cities. Even though I don't like that they are, but we'll talk about that later. Or really now. What have you not liked, ladies?
Well, before I talk about that, I have to go back and say, like, I was thinking about some of the other things that I liked about, like, the whole whodunit of it all. Is that, you know, as you go through the episode, you see points where we're supposed to believe that Team Arrow is telling the truth. And then there's, like, these little things where you figure out that they lied. Like, the first one was, like, Felicity was saying that there were no two guards. I never saw two guards. But you see in her flashback that she did see the two guards. Like, oh my god, she lied! Why? And then I think there's something else that either Diggle or Renee, like, lied about. And said they were somewhere where they weren't, or they were doing something that they didn't do. I was like, oh my god, liars, what's going on? So it's like every time you think that you know something, they like reveal a little piece of it that there's a lie here. And so like you go from Arrow being totally truthful to Arrow is telling lies to like the final reveal of like Dinah being in on it. It's like the biggest like mind fuck of the episode. So I really like all of that kind of fits together and to you, like, trying to, you know, not blink or you'll miss some clue or some other lie is being told. But, like, while finding out, going into my dislikes, finding out that the answer to the whole mystery, like, I almost feel like I shouldn't be saying, like, what the answer is. Like, that's how I'm best like, mystery.
Watch the
episode. Spoilers. Like, this is late to say spoilers, but I've not watched the episode. Go watch the episode. But, like, finding out that the answer to the mystery was both that Roy killed these guards and that Team Arrow covered it up. It was, like, the best and the worst parts of the episode. It's the best, like, reveal because it's shocking that none of them, you think that someone's telling the truth. It turns out, like, none of them are telling the truth and that they are covering up for Roy. Like, I spent the first half of the episode being really annoyed at how cocky and nonchalant Felicity, in particular, Oliver and Felicity, were acting at the fact that two security guards died for doing their job, and they didn't really seem particularly keen on justice being served about that. They're like, well, we saved the city, you're welcome. Kind of this, like, cavalier attitude, especially with, like, the sergeant of the police force, and even a little bit of Dinah. And so I was annoyed about how they were just, like, cavalierly, you know, throwing away these two guards and being like, well, the city was safe, so you're welcome. And I was particularly excited on Dinah's behalf because I thought that she was a good person. And I was mad that Team Arrow didn't trust her enough to loop her into the plan because if they had, maybe this wouldn't have happened. So I was really annoyed at them. And then by the second half of the episode, I think I was more pissed that Dinah actually was part of the mission. Like, why wasn't Dinah part of the mission? And then find out that she was, I'm like, why were you part of the mission, Dinah? because it meant that her being part of the mission was also part of her being part of the cover-up plan. And at best, Team Arrow are accessories to murder in obstruction of justice. And that is, like, that being the best possibility is actually, like, pretty awful. It would have been so much better for me if Dinah didn't know what was happening so that she could just have plausible deniability. I think that's what she was going for in the beginning, but she just hadn't been there, or maybe knew that they were going to do that, but not join in the mission, and she would have some plausible deniability at that point, but she doesn't. So, like, now, not only has she lost her canary cry, but she also lost her job, she's also going to lose her credibility, and I can't help but think about how harshly Dinah treated Laurel, or Judge Laurel, for her minor indiscretion in the canary episode, and just, like, laugh. Like, Laurel got me laughing somewhere. Because, like, Dinah just royally just, like, screwed up her entire future. Like, I don't understand. Why did you do this, Dinah? Like, this is why you can't do all the things your little white friends are doing, because it gets you in trouble. Like, she feels like she's lost, like, the most, she's taking the most L's of anybody on Team Arrow in this episode, even into the future. Because after this, after being accessories to murder, Felicity still goes on to have smoke tech. Renee somehow becomes the mayor of the Glaive after killing or being accessory to killing two people. Diggle's running, like, Night Watch or whatever Argus thing is. And then, you know, Dinah's just, like, hiding in the shadows with, like, canaries, trying to make a difference somewhere, but not just being, you know, remembered at all, kind of, really. So, who's took the most L's this episode? Dinah had the most lose, and she definitely lost it. So, I'm a little, like, annoyed with Dinah, to be honest, and the fact that she willingly participated in covering up the murder of two officers that were doing their job. I can't get over Team Arrow chose to cover up murder. Like, oh my god. And, like, Roy knowing his situation and accepting a mission and told no one the truth about his condition. And I thought it was just, like, really rude or just, like, not
responsible. Right, just, like, irresponsible.
Yeah, it was irresponsible for him to do that. And then Oliver deciding to cover it up and frame his sister for Roy's mistakes. I feel like was the camel, the straw that put the camel's back. And, like, I know Emiko is evil, blah, 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 blah. But part of me feels like, what if, like, she could have sent in that footage at any point in time during, like, the interrogation, but she didn't. So it wasn't until after Emiko is, like, thrown under the bus by her brother that she lured him out and dropped the building on him. So, like, what if Emiko only sent the video to the SCPD because Oliver tried to frame her? That's reminding her of her ancient daddy Robert that left her all those years ago. Oliver chose Roy over Emiko, just like Robert chose Oliver over Emiko and Theo over Emiko. It's like, yes, I think it's ridiculous that Emiko is all, like, at Heart Lies, it seems like it's treating you like shit and feel threatened when you treat me the same way I'm treating you. But I also wonder if she was in some way, like, testing him or something to see if he was the same person as her father. And by Oliver throwing her under the bus to protect Roy, he proved himself, like, unworthy of her. So I don't know. Like, I feel like all of this could have also been helped if Oliver had just called Thea, to be honest. Like, that would have been a better reunion and story by getting her involved instead of Roy. And let's just be real, like, how upset could Thea be about Robert having a secret daughter when she was also a secret daughter? Like, it seems like she and Emiko would have the most in common, and Thea would have done a better job reaching out to Emiko than Oliver, seeing as how they had that in common. And also, even though by the end we know that they were all acting, I thought it was really super arrogant and cocky how Oliver and Felicity were acting towards Diana and the police sergeant. And it would make it even worse that they know that they're guilty and covering up a murder, and yet they still have the audacity to trade barbs with the sergeant and try to make him, the SCPD, look incompetent. So, like, for the first time, I feel like I'm beginning to understand, like, how vigilantes are so hated in 2049. And this whole mission was just, like, a really big clusterfuck. And the fact that they're trying to pretend like everything is fine is really messing with them. Like, even after they get back and they think they've gotten away with murder, I don't know, maybe they should call it Viola Davis because it wasn't working. But I don't know, like, Annalise Keating, get them on the line, get because they need a lawyer right now. But the fact that they thought that this would be, like, a viable solution to Roy killing two people was just, it's just messing with me. I can't get over it.
I mean, this explains their tattoos, though.
Yes. Covering up murders to the god.
We're all part of the club now, the guilty club. Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I honestly found the reason to bring Roy back kind of weak. And it's frustrating that they told us that Oliver still keeps in touch with Thea, but that he hasn't told her about Emiko, and she didn't tell him that Roy had died and been brought back to life. Like, I guess they just discussed the weather. It's like 65 degrees outside, you guys, and that's all. And even if they couldn't bring back Thea, Nyssa appearing isn't outside the realm of possibility, especially since she made an appearance in the flash forwards not that long ago. And Roy showing up without either Nyssa or Thea's backup and then not telling the team about his condition, knowing he wasn't okay, was a big problem that didn't sit well with me. It was irresponsible and could have definitely been avoided overall. Team Arrow had been doing so well up until this point without him. So, I don't know. In comes Roy and just, like, fucks everything up.
No, like, why don't ask Nyssa? Like, Nyssa would have been a better choice.
Yeah.
Roy.
It's, yeah, that's absolutely true. And like you, Jess, I was also disappointed that Oliver threw Emiko under the bus. But not only did he throw her under the bus, he kind of threw himself and his team under the bus, too, at least in the eyes of law. And it's frustrating after considering how hard they have all worked to be seen as law-abiding citizens who weren't going back to their old ways. And we're gonna work with the police, even though we didn't really want to, but they've come so far, and then this happened. So what is Arrow trying to say? Like, that the team can only do the right thing, but not when it comes to outing one of their own? And they're acting like they're above the law right now, and they threw everything away to help Roy, who's only been there for 5 minutes, instead of making him face the consequences of murder like Oliver did in the recent past. And what makes the whole thing worse is the fact that the guards weren't criminals, but innocent guys caught in the middle, and Team Arrow didn't even act like they cared. So the whole situation just made everybody look bad. Oliver abandoned Emiko in favor of Roy, which is not a good look, and then he'd been really trying with her. So for a guy who's always going on about protecting his extended family, I guess that doesn't count for her anymore, which is really sad. And then Diana threw away her career, like you said, which is tragic considering she went off on Laurel, doing things outside the law while she was the DA, and she could have helped from the inside, but that's not going to happen anymore. And then she gave that up for Roy, someone she doesn't even know that well, to be honest.
She met him, like,
right.
Anyway.
So, they gave up their futures for this. Okay, that's fine, whatever. And then finally, I didn't like this, like you guys did, and didn't think it was cute. It's a nitpick, but I think Felicity was too much for me this episode. All the munching to remind us she's pregnant, like, I don't always need reminders, personally, and the way that she was acting while she was being interrogated specifically was a bit excessive, in my opinion.
That's fair. I guess they have to, like, remind us, like, repeatedly because she's not showing yet, and then in the finale, they're going to, like, jump forward. She's going to be, like, super pregnant, so, so, like, just, like,
right.
Where did that come from? Like, oh, pregnant. Yeah.
I thought it was ridiculous that Oliver called Roy specifically because he didn't want to tell Thea about Emiko. And I understand that Willa Holland can't come to the phone right now, and that's why we have Roy instead. But I just feel like they could have done something else to explain why Thea wasn't there. Like, maybe Thea does know what's going on, but she's too busy with a Lazarus pit or, you know, with a Thanatos Guild or whatever, so she can't come right now. And that's why she sent Roy. Yeah.
That would have been something if he called Thea and Thea's like, I don't want to go, and she sends Roy. It was like, what does that mean kind of thing.
Exactly. Just, I think that just sets Oliver back. Like, it makes him look like he's still keeping secrets. He still thinks that Thea's not strong enough to handle it, etc. It just makes him look dumb. Which is fine, I guess, because he is dumb this episode. also, all of Team Arrow was, like, even before we found out they were covering up a murder that they were an accessory to, or two murders that they were accessories to, they were so wildly callous and unfeeling about the deaths of these security guards. And they were, like, harping so much on, like, the greater good. Like, oh, well, we saved the city or whatever. So it doesn't really matter that these two guys died. But I don't know. Like, I was expecting, like, the reveal to be something like the guards were actually really bad, but you couldn't say that for reasons. You know, like, I don't know. The fact that it's just, like, two random innocent dudes just makes them look super shitty. Also, like, I don't really care about pinning two more murders on Emiko, because she is evil and she does want to kill everyone. So I'm like, okay, I mean, that just adds two more to infinity, so it's fine. But I do care about the team impinging on their own integrity and losing their credibility in the process of doing that. Like, they've been harping so much on doing it the right way, right? Following the law, working with the city in order to protect it. And now they're just, like, throwing that to the wind so that they can protect Roy. And again, like, Roy has been there for Oliver and Felicity and whatever since the beginning. So it's like, I'm not like, oh, they don't know Roy. Because, yes, Dinah shouldn't agree. Like, I don't feel for a second that Dinah would be like, yes, I'm going to do this. This would be a great moment for them to break up again. Because she don't know Roy. But whatever, they all agree to be in on this nonsense for some reason. And then, like, furthermore, like, they not only don't care about those two guards, but, like, they don't care that Roy is experiencing this uncontrollable bloodlust, and so they're still going to take him on the next mission. Like, what if it happens again? I don't understand. You're not going to do anything to prevent it? You're just like, that's cool. Join us. And I'm like, okay, go home now, Roy. Thank you for wasting everyone's time. But whatever. Oliver looks like more of a hypocrite than ever before. And like I said, I don't believe that Dinah would agree to this. Also, like I had said previously, I'm glad we're seeing the cause and effect with Archer and with the SCPD partnership, so we get how Star City got to 2040, and we see why it's kind of Team Arrow's fault, but at the same time, it's like a really bleak way to end the series, because no matter what they do in 2040 to fix things, it will always be the case that Oliver and his team were responsible for messing up the city for two decades. At best, Oliver will die saving the universe to make up for the fact that he failed this city. Which is just that. So, aside from that prediction, that is my prediction, what predictions do you guys have?
Well, I'm still on my Oliver died last episode. That's my overarching prediction. I don't know about... Well, he might die the next week, because he's still got that building on top of him. And then I don't know what's going to happen with Roy. I don't know. I'm just throwing stuff out there to the wind because I didn't write anything down.
Roy will be banned to the island because that's where William ends up going. And that's
he'll probably.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he and Thea will not get their happy ending because of what happened. Because
he killed two people.
Yeah. He killed two people. He feels guilty, so he's sentencing himself to,
like,
you know, atone for his sins. Right. But she cares off screen.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. Now we can move on to our Lady with Gumption nomination for Side A.
No one from Arrow.
It's Nia.
It is Nia. Nia is the only option.
Nia is Side A, so moving on.
Side D is coordinated assault / doormat / sensitive acquisition. Beginning with the Flash, gone rogue. Barry continues to struggle with how he feels about Nora's betrayal. Brie Larvin, don't call her Bug-Eyed Bandit, Joss Jackham, don't call her Weather Wizard, and Peter Merkle, don't call him Creepy Contortionist from America's Got Talent, return to Central City. Meanwhile, Cisco makes a bold decision to one day make a bold decision. Kristen Wendell directed the episode, written by Sam Shelton and Joshua V. Gilbert. What did we like about the episode, other than Jessica laughing silently because she is on mute?
Makes a bold decision to make a bold decision.
So things that I liked. I liked the return of Brie Larson, aka Buckeye Bandit, and Friends. I liked that it was not as lame as I thought it was going to be, because, like, when I saw she was back, I was like, why? Because 118 was not spectacular at all, so, but it turned out to be okay. And Cisco's like, hey, girl! When he saw her, so it was, like, one of the funniest moments of the episode for me. So I agree with one of our feedback people that just, he's been so underutilized season 5, and this is one of the main reasons, like, people like Cisco is for his one-liners and the energy that he brings to scenes. So I really like that we got to see that this episode. And it also helped with the connection from season 1. If anyone forgot who Bug-Eye Bandit was, then Cisco helping them to, like, reconnect and, like, oh, yeah, Crazy B-Girl. I know her. So I thought that was good. And I even got, like, a mini little excess weather moment when Joss and Nora bonded over being abandoned by their parents. So, yay! OTP, my parent left me. I was hoping for something after Weather Wizard said that her girlfriend, like, she and Silver Ghost, like, broke up. Like, I know they weren't, like, together, but, like, the fact that they broke up in my mind.
Kind of were.
And that, you know, Nora was breaking bad for a minute. Like, yes, I can get it.
You're like, no, very tea.
But then it went soft. So, that was a short-lived little OTP moment for me, but whatever. The crisscross applesauce of, like, Nora double-crossing her parents, and then being double-crossed by the Rogues, who had then reverse double-crossed when Barry Iris and Joe revealed themselves to be cast agents, was all really great. Not, like, the Nora double-crossing her parents part, but, like, the end, when, you know, Barry Iris and Joe come up with this plan to save Nora from herself and from the Rogues, was really great. The team, like, I don't need superpowers to be a man's ass of Joe and Iris, showed, like, some excellent teamwork, and I really liked the meta that they got put up against the Ragdoll, because it was round 2 for Iris, and once she knocked his ass out, she mentioned the desire to unlock the roof, which was a nice little bit of continuity to 505 when he tried to throw Barry off the roof. So I really liked that. And I liked Ragdoll as, like, a villain. I thought him, when, like, Nora put up, like, a tiny-ass little briefcase, I'm like, no way, there is no way that he's gonna crawl out, and he, like, crawls out the suitcase, and the tech tell him to go into the sewage pipe. So I'm like, no, there's no way. And then, of course, he's like, flutters up in there, and I was like, oh my god, this is just, like, gross and fascinating to watch at the same time. So I liked that he was back. The other father-daughter duo, like, Barry and Nora, and the whole, you came for me, it was, like, super cheesy. Like, it was ridiculously cheesy. It was, like, the Barry, like, flying in front of the lightning bolt, and the whole flash time thing, it was just super, super cheesy, but it works for, you know, what they're trying to accomplish, so that was fine. And I swear, I thought Barry, the hologram Barry, was Ralph doing the hologram, because it just seemed, like, super ridiculous in the way that Ralph would think Barry would act, but it was Sherlock. And I guess, like, I wanted to see Ralph, but Ralph had to make the C-plot interesting, so that's where he was, with Caitlin, over in her dad's lab. I thought, for the little that we got to see of him, the main part was setting up Ralph's love story. I thought it was a rushed way to tell us that we're going to most likely get a glimpse of Sue in maybe the next episode or two, but Hartley, as an actor, has really made Ralph into such a genuine character that you really feel for him when he says that, you know, he reveals that he thinks that he's incapable of being loved. Like, the book of Ralph, the love book of Ralph works for everyone but him, because he's not capable of love. So that was really sad. But then you get, like, the bonus of Ralph telling Caitlin, like, you know, I don't have those kind of feelings for you, when he mistook Caitlin's comfort as a come on. I thought that was hilarious. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, but no, thank you. Cecile and Iris investigating Gating Life. Love that. Want more of it. Also, Central City Citizen is looking really beautiful. Very well decorated.
I really wish Cecile and Iris had got to follow through on actually going and investigating that lead they were headed to. But already, just showing us that, one, she and Cecile were working on something, and two, they were going to follow through, and showing that on camera is more than what we usually get when we get storylines of Iris investigating, because they would have had that, let's go investigate off-screen somewhere. So I'm glad that we actually got to see it this time. And I get it because it was a little crowded in Central City Citizen with the West family, plus Barry, plus Barry's pride, all in that little space. But, like, the only thing I thought was missing was a glimpse of Camilla. So thank you, Cisco, for name-dropping her. Let us know that, one, she still exists, and two, that your relationship is still going strong, even if that means you have to share your relationship struggles in a parallel with Sherlock, who is missing out on all kinds of sex because he cannot understand an eggplant emoji on his phone. So, like, like, you don't know what that eggplant emoji means. So, like, Sherlock is missing out on all kinds of sex he could be having. But I do like that at least most of that storyline was focused on Cisco's decision of why he hasn't told Camilla that he's vibe yet and how he plans to move forward with that in the future.
All excellent likes. One of the most interesting, I feel like I like this episode more than other people. One of the most interesting things about the season was how Barry and Iris took to parenting very differently. And I like the show finally, after 20 episodes, acknowledged that Barry wasn't as into the idea of having Nora around in the present as much as Iris was.
That was
mine too. Yeah, like, he's always been more distant. We've seen it, and he's kept her at arm's length, and I'm really happy that he finally talked about it. Like, even if we think all the way back to the season 4 finale, when Iris even suggested kids, he was freaking out. So it's no surprise that he doesn't think he'll either be a good parent or that he wasn't ready to have kids. But now I definitely think he will be moving forward, so that was nice to hear from him. And parts of that kind of mirror Iris' storyline with Nora, but this one's, like, a little bit less fleshed out, which is one of my issues, because it should have come earlier in the season. But still, I like the talk he had with Joe. And I'm also glad that Joe reminded us, all of us, that Barry had a dad, and his name was Henry. Speaking of the heart-to-heart with Joe, it was just really nice to see so many of these kinds of conversations in one episode. Iris got to share her concerns with Cecile, and Barry did the same with Joe. Then Nora finally got to tell Barry how much it hurt that he's pushed her away before giving us their nice makeup scene at the end. And I like that Barry owned up to Nora's face that it wasn't right to have sent her to the future and just left her there. And I like the sentiment that him and Iris both believed in Nora, even though they, and I mean Barry, didn't believe Fawn. I probably liked, like I said, I probably liked this episode more than others because I know that some people did not, but I did enjoy seeing Weather Witch, Bug-Eyed Bandit, and Ragdoll again. It was a nice way to keep the rogues alive without having to go back to the old ones. And just, like, they always fail, but it's so cute to watch them try, right? And then Nora's plan, though it had, like, issues that I will discuss later, was good in general. I like that she played them, and then they played her before West Island's family clan showed up and took them all down. And that one scene with Sherlock as Barry, and then the face changer reveal was pretty epic. And I like that they brought back all those instruments. Like, we had the face changer from season 3, and then the hologram from season 4, or it showed up in season 2 even. So all of that was brought back, and it was used really well. And then Iris and Joe fighting side by side, parallels with Barry and Nora doing the same was really nice. And then, like Jess said, Ragdoll versus Iris round 2, she still whooped his ass, loved the ponytail toss and the roof reference. And I like Cisco mentioning all the throwbacks. Like, his delight over seeing Bug-Eyed Bandit made me smile so big because I missed him last episode a lot. And I'm glad he got some time to think about and get to the bottom of his feelings regarding being vibe, what that means, and then letting Camilla in on his secret. I guess they're that far along in their relationship, which I'd like to see more of, but, you know, whatever.
My Monique voice.
And I actually thought Kaylin and Ralph's scene was touching. Like, that one moment where he was admitting that he wasn't built for love. I thought that was really sad, but I did like the advice Caitlin gave him, I liked the advice that she gave him and that he thought she was coming on to him. I guess this is, like, the closest we'll ever get to what was supposed to be a romance between these two. But eventually, like, the conversation definitely teased Sue Dibney for either, like, the end of the season or next season, most likely.
And then, bless.
Yeah. Finally, West Allen family and Cisco investigating together. The team-up we always need more of. Then Iris and Cecile investigating made me so happy. And even better, they weren't doing it in Star Labs but in Iris' office. So more of that in season 6 so that we can actually see what's happening outside of that raggedy old basement.
Yes. I had a lot of fun watching Queen Bee, Weather Witch, and Ragdoll team up with Nora. It was definitely much better than I expected it to be. I liked Nora's little teenage rebellion and the fact that it actually doubled as a real plan to stop Takeda, which it seems no one has had all season long, so I'm glad that we finally have one with 2 episodes to go. So yeah, that little reversal actually ended up working for me. And for the most part, the massive series of crosses and double crosses worked for me as well. I liked that we learned that she was being dramatic on purpose in order to be able to successfully use the negative speed force. Because I remember being like, why are you being like this? And I was just like, oh, I was doing it. I had to be like this. I was like, okay. But at the same time, I also liked that Joss put her in her place with a story of what actual parental abandonment looks like. Yes. I was like, yes, I'm so sad for you that you fought with your father as a 25-year-old this one time. But this is what shitty parents are actually like. I also, like I said, I liked the sudden but inevitable betrayal, except for, like, one aspect of it. But it was extra awesome to see the comeback, to see Wes Allen, the Wes Allen family step in with the face changers, which, nice callback, by the way. I don't know why we don't use those more often. And Sherlock with the hologram. Another great callback, and something we should use more often. Although, I guess that one was used most recently, like, what, season 4? So,
or wait,
early season 5, right? I don't know.
Yes, it was used
very recently.
Just, like, I'm not gonna fall for this again, kind of thing.
So yeah.
Season 5, most recently.
Yeah, it was great. Loved Iris knocking out Ragdoll. Especially, like, first she got knocked out, and I was like, is this a first? Iris just went to the ground. Oh, my God, I can't believe this. I can't believe she's going to lose her streak. And then she's like, no, I get knocked down, and I get up again.
What's that song? I get knocked down.
Yeah.
I get up again.
I get up again. Yeah, that's the one. So, I love that. Also, it was kind of poor Joe had to get like, the arm twist of his life, but I like also seeing father and daughter fight side by side. Like May pointed out, it was also Barry and Nora, as well as Joe and Iris, so that was nice. Also, there was just, like, a lot of great Wes Allen family content throughout the episode. We got Steele and Iris investigating, and Barry, Joe, and Iris investigating in the same episode. Like, I've never been so blessed. Also, Barry tried to reach out to Nora, Iris tried to reason with Barry, Joe dispensed his sage fatherly wisdom, and also admitted that he thinks about arresting his kids every week, which was the highlight of the episode for me. I'll never forget this. He's like, every week my kids do some illegal shit, and I'm like, I'm a cop. Anyway. And I also liked Barry, Iris, and Nora working things out at the end for the most part. Again, we can talk about that later. Cisco, mostly back to his old self. Great to have him, period. But I also actively enjoyed his banter with Sherlock this episode. I liked how over it he was when he got kidnapped. He's like, okay, come on, this Rogues cover band, please. And just how, like, he was just kind of like, okay, I'm going to do this, and then we're going to stop you guys anyway. So, like, why don't we just skip to that part? So all of that was fun. I also, like, you know, I appreciated that he was actually kind of struggling with what I want you to tell Camilla. So, yeah, just really liked his assistance this week. Thank you, Cisco. Finally, I thought, you know, Ralph continued his sweetheart streak this week. It was really nice of him to try to get Caitlin or Killer Frost to come out of her shell. And then equally nice of Caitlin to want him to repay that favor to himself. I really did feel bad for him when he said he wasn't made for love. And then, you know, he immediately ruined it by thinking Caitlin was into him. But that was, like, a cute way. Like, you're like, okay, so this is why you're not made for love yet, because you're still a dork. And I cannot wait for Sue to show up. So, I don't know. Some of y'all don't want Sue. I don't care. I want Sue. I'm ready. I'm ready. And there's no way that Sue, you know, Sue can't be another Ralph or Nora situation. So, don't worry about it. You know, like, season 4, Ralph took over. Season 5, Nora took over. It's not like Sue would come and tell me the show. The show's about Sue.
Sue's not connected to Barry. So, she's connected to Ralph. Yeah. We'll be okay. She'll be Camilla.
She'll be Camilla. All right. So what do we not like?
I'm gonna be honest, like, I didn't like the hallway fight scene in the sense, between Barry and Iris, in the sense that Iris was just so, like, so, when Barry brought up the fact that Nora's playing a song's idea, because, like, we've been through enough seasons of the same storyline happening over and over again on the show to know that when a bad guy shows you who they are, you believe them the first time. And specifically for Barry, there's been too many times that Barry has fallen for the okey-doke and believed the villain and then thought the villain could change, only to have the villain double-cross him again or something like that. And so I hate that they keep writing the show into this, like, clap if you believe naivete of Team Flash. It's the corny thing. I understand where Iris is coming from, and that she believes her daughter, and she believes in Nora, and that if Nora and Nora's judgment thinks that it's a good idea, even if it comes from a bad person, that it's still a good idea. But I think the writing for it was clunky. It makes it seem like Nora, like Iris, is disregarding everything they know to be true about Bond, which isn't the case. I like that she believes that her daughter is enough to change Bond, but I didn't like the clunky way that it was presented, as in she doesn't really care that it's Thawne's idea, and how she phrased it to Barry, knowing Barry's relationship with Thawne, and why it would be so difficult for him to trust Thawne. She's just kind of phrasing it as, you know, Thawne has helped us so much, instead of, like, let's believe our daughter in what, you know, in her judgment and that kind of thing. So I thought it was, like, clunky and did disservice to Iris, but it feels like they wrote it clunky on purpose so then Joe could have the exact same conversation with Barry with the added lens of father first, cop second, in a way that Barry could understand. And I didn't write it in my life, so I did like the larger conversation between Joe and Barry, where Barry does admit that, you know, he sucks at this whole parenting thing and have all his insecurities about that, because it does, like, bring up the explicitly what we've seen from the first episode where he wanted her to go back immediately. So, like, all of that was brought up, and how Joe framed it in the sense of what I said last week, is that this is not another member of Team Flash, this is your daughter. You have different standards for your child than you have for your coworker or whatever. Joe basically said the same thing Iris did, except that he framed it in the lens of being a father and being a parent. And that is the way that Barry can understand. And I think that they wrote Iris clunky to make this moment shine. And so it just feels like he did a disservice to Iris and her perspective, the way that they wrote it. Over on this season of Bad Girls Club, Meta Edition, I think that Nora, well, I'm glad that she had a purpose, like a real purpose, actually going bad and joining the Rogues. I feel like her pretending to be bad and recruiting criminals and liars to help her steal military-grade weapons, all because her dad wouldn't listen to an idea that she had, is exactly the reason that Iris called her excessive as a child, because it just seems like an excessive thing to do. And the fact that she's like, oh, I had to be in this headspace and shout out all these like, nasty things and, you know, pretend to put a hand through Cisco, because it's acting, you know, it's like, this just seems like a very excessive way to go about getting what you want. It just seems like a lot. And considering that Nora ultimately had zero control over her three recruits, it was just reckless and dangerous for her to even consider as a viable option compared to maybe talking to her mom or talking to other reasonable people that are not her dad and getting them on board with her plan. Like, that seems like it would be like a lot less. I do like that she actually put her anger at the right place against Barry and, like, lashed out at him for everything that he did, but just, like, when you put that in the context of everything she's doing, that she said she had to do that thing, those things, it just seems, like, excessive to me. And especially her threatening Cisco with a hand to the chest, like, reverse flash, knowing that that's a trigger for him, I thought was just a little bit too far, kind of crossed the line. And considering that she was doing that because she was quote-unquote acting, I don't know if she has apologized, will apologize for that. It doesn't seem like she will or the writers won't acknowledge it. So it's just kind of torture pain for the audience. And I didn't enjoy it. Short was torture porn, actually. Torture porn for the audience, and I did not enjoy.
Yeah. I know how much Iris loves Nora, and that means protecting her at every chance she gets, even from her father's unwillingness to believe her. But I gotta say that I wish she'd been a bit more skeptical this episode. Like, Nora may trust Thom, and claims it's all a good plan and so on, but I don't think Nora herself has proven that she is worthy of that trust, given how reckless and excessive she's shown herself to be. So even if she didn't walk away from this experience questioning her mentor, which is unrealistic, it's because of the Nora angle that I didn't like some parts of the hallway fight. Iris has been too lenient and patient with Nora, and this child deserves some consequences for her actions.
Right?
It's like the whole idea that she made them better people, and I'm like, Iris, how? When?
Like, you don't even like, talk this season. How are you better?
Yeah.
Very broken child. How is that better?
Like, she's blinded by her love for Nora, and I completely get that. But it's also okay to question your child. On the flip side, Barry came off as a bit of a hypocrite, too, considering he's given second chances to literally every villain, including Savitar, who tried to kill Iris, and then even told Nora in 5:10 that it is possible Thom could change, and now he doesn't believe it when Iris is suggesting it to his face. So I agree with Jess, though, that how they're thinking about this whole thing is naive, given all they've been through in the past, especially since we know that Thom will probably betray them. But
he'll betray them.
Yeah.
Probably is them going up against him.
But in this specific instance, I think Barry was, like, his questioning of Thom, like, it's not okay to work with him, was right. Like, it shouldn't be okay for Nora to work with him. Where do they draw the line? You can still believe people can change, but also not trust them after you've been burned by them one too many times.
Exactly.
And I can't even begin to tell you what happened in the Caitlin and Ralph subplot, except for the love advice, so it was mostly a waste of screen time. But I will say that Caitlin mourning her father is something the writers really don't care about at all, since the story shifted so fast towards Ralph, it gave me whiplash. And I didn't care much for Sherlock's issues with Irene either, and this is because I don't care for him as a person. But that and the fact that he thinks Nora is his responsibility made me eye roll. Like, sit down, Sherlock, you've done enough. She is not your responsibility. There's already another Wells, you know, another guy in Wells' face trying to...
Don't worry about any worse parent. Like, how is she so
lovable? And I can honestly argue that Nora could have come to her mom with the plan, because she could have, since she came to her, you know, since Iris went to rescue her from the future. But I'm going to chalk that up to Nora knowing that even if she did tell her mom about the plan, Iris would have still gone to Barry and tried to appeal to him about how good of an idea it was. And then that probably would have taken too long, and she was just like, overthinking things, and then that would have put Iris in an awkward situation, and she would have actively had to take a side. So I'm fine with Nora leaving both parents out of it for the sake of the plan in this instance. But I did take issue with Nora not thanking Iris for believing in her and coming to get her in the first place. Like, when Iris told her that she and Barry would never leave her again, it rang false, because Iris never left her to begin with and had actively tried to get her back to solve things. So it would have made Nora look more appreciative to the mother who's been on her side through all of this. So that aspect left a lot to be desired. And then also the fact that she used the vibrating hand, like Jess said, on Sisko was really cruel and unnecessary, even though it was a throwback. But I disagree, Sisko. It's an oldie, but it's not a goodie. And I liked Bad Girl Nora, but I was underwhelmed with the negative Speed Force side of things. Like, I guess I assumed that it would play more of a factor in Nora's behavior, but it kind of got swept under the rug. Though we could see that, you know, happen next week with the effect. But the way I see it was the writers wanted to give Nora an out. Like, she could break bad, just not all the way. But I think she got the short end of the stick primarily because the exploration of her abandonment issues also got shortchanged. Like, Barry left her, like, 2 episodes ago, and then he leaves her in the future. So part of it is that she probably saw it as him not caring enough about her in any timeline to stick around. But it goes back to the fact that if they'd started this particular angsty subplot earlier, we'd have gotten way more out of it. But like I mentioned maybe like 2 podcast episodes ago, there's also the lack of development regarding the issue of Barry's disappearance to begin with. So that leaves everything else tying back to it lacking an emotional payoff.
I feel even in Joe and Barry's conversation where he's like, I don't know if I'll be a good parent, that would have been a great time. Like, I'm not even going to be around.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Also, if there was a weapon that could render Cicada's dagger useless, like, why didn't Thom suggest the idea to Nora earlier? And then finally, while this episode was like a decent and generally enjoyable filler, it didn't feel urgent enough. And I hope that changes going into the final 2 episodes. Plus, I'm not thrilled that Chris Klein is back being, you know, Cicada, whether it's a hallucination or not, I really don't care. but I, to add to your point, Jess, about, like, Barry's father stuff, that could have completely come into play since, like, at least, the 100th episode, you know, where they explore all that stuff with his parents, and they could have started that way back then. I think they just started to, and it just didn't really.
Like, he gave us relationship advice. Like, well, we're just going to marry him when it's anyway, so many missed opportunities.
Okay. I think Nora needs to be grounded for threatening Cisco with a hand phase to the heart. Not cool at all. And it was definitely like the one part where, like, when she did that, I was like, well, there's no explanation for this. She can't do that. I did not like that. Also didn't like that the episode, like, reset Joss's partial redemption from the last time we saw her. Like, she was the one that didn't actually want to kill Nora when Silver Ghost was pushing her to, and she was also the one that was genuinely scared at the trial when she was talking about, like, she was genuinely, whatever. Basically, Cecile was like, oh, my emotion sensor senses that she's being genuine about what she's saying. So anyway, so I didn't like that. Now she's like, huh, I basically killed Silver Ghost, probably, and now I'm going to kill you too. I was like, whatever. I don't like this.
He's got that wand back, so maybe it's, like, messing with her again.
Yeah, I guess there you go. It's the wand. Damn you, wand!
Blame the wand.
Yeah. But anyway, I did, I liked seeing her again, but, you know, I just would have liked maybe, like, Silver Ghost would have made more sense personality-wise with a double cross. Not that I wanted to see Silver Ghost, so I guess I'll just take it. But I'm still peeved. Anyway, I have to agree with y'all, like, Iris's reaction in the hallway argument was a little bit weak. It became redundant because it was just there to, like, pad Joe's speech so that Joe could then refer back to it. But at the same time, I think that the bigger issue I have is, like, I know Iris is right because anything Iris says is right. Like, that's just and I'm not making it up. Like, the show will use Iris as, like, the mouthpiece of, like, the objective truth. So, of course, I love that because I love Iris. But I don't love it when they don't back it up. And in this case, it's really hard because the way they've written Nora does not coincide with the way they want Nora to be viewed. So Iris saying, like, Nora's made us better people, so maybe she did that to Thawne, is really hard to imagine because we haven't really seen them be better people because of Nora. Right. Nora has made them more exhausted people. but, like, there's nothing inherently about her or the way they've written her, that would explain why someone would be better because of her.
Aside from, like, since half the season just, like, hating her mom for...
Right.
That she hadn't even done yet.
Yeah. And so yeah, it's kind of weird. Like, and also just, like, the way that they went so hard with, like, with the rift between Iris and Nora, and which was really interesting and upsetting at first, but then we found out the truth, and it was like, oh, so Nora just, like, made up this entire, you know, feud. It wasn't really like that. She just found out the truth and she's really upset about it. And that's, you know, so I don't know. I feel like Nora does sort of, like, seem like she has issues that the show's not actually dealing with. So, I don't know. It makes Iris' argument weaker because the show isn't backing up what she's saying, even though it is, for them, the truth.
Right.
Okay. Also, I, you know, like you said, it bothers me how Nora continues to have a laser focus on Barry. And we got that feedback that is very accurate. It's because Barry versus Thawne is the overall arc of the season that they were obscuring at first. So, Iris and Nora doesn't contribute to that. And that's why. But it still makes it feel like the show doesn't care about the role that Iris plays in the family. And that Nora doesn't care.
Yeah, it's like implicitly, like, you're supposed to see that Iris is the glue that holds her family together,
yes.
But they never explicitly say that or have Barry or Nora thank her for being that glue.
Right. Yeah, exactly. One of them, like, should have said that in the scene, like, thank you, Iris, for making us see eye to eye or whatever, you know? But they didn't, because they...
Yeah, I don't even know if we'll get that in the finale. I don't know if they're saving that for the finale, but it doesn't seem like they will care enough to... make that explicit in the finale that it's Iris that kind of helps them together. So,
I mean, I feel like if they do, it'll just be incidental. It won't be, like, you know, me. And they'll just be like, it just happened to sneak in there. But, I also, I can't believe there's two episodes left. And, like, Cicada just now finally feels like a threat at the very end of his episode. When it's like, oh, Cicada has a potential virus that's going to kill off metahumans. And I'm like, oh, that's scary. But Cicada only has that because Sisko and Caitlin just, like, left it in the lair of Caitlin's evil alter ego dad. Like, it was already there, just waiting. So that guy could use it at any moment. And I'm like, wow, y'all are really bad at this. So I don't know. That was very stupid. And I also don't like that they brought up, like, I liked it when it seemed like the struggle was, do I tell Camille or not? Like, I need, if I want to be with her, then I have to, Camilla. If I tell Camilla, or as the writers were telling us subconsciously who we need to vote for, Kamala. Sherlock did not change the name. Like, he didn't just say a random number of names that were similar to Camilla. He just said Kamala over and over again. So now you know who you're supposed to vote for. Anyway, I liked it when that was the struggle, but then when they introduced, like, oh, well, maybe you don't even want to be live anymore, and that's why. I don't like that, because then that reminds me of, like, oh, maybe you don't even want to be on the team anymore. And you better not go anywhere, Carlos. I'm watching you. So last but not least, I will feel no sense of surprise when Thawne betrays them, just like the Rogues did this episode. And I will have to be okay with Barry saying, I told you so to everyone. I don't like that.
Yeah.
So there we go. What do you guys predict?
Well, I will say one nitpick that I did have, because when you brought up, like, Sherlock mispronouncing Camilla's name, it brought up, like, earlier in the episode where, you know, everyone's like, oh, Caitlin, are you okay? Because your dad does. Oh, I'm sad, but I'm going to work through it. Sherlock, do you want to help me? He's like, it's Sherlock. So he was so upset that you could, and that no one could get his name right. And yet he spent this entire episode mispronouncing everybody else's name and not, like, correcting it when they gave him the correct name. So it's kind of, I can understand, because, like, some people sometimes, like, in emails, even though my name is in the email address, they'll call me, like, a different name. Mm-hmm. And one time, like, I just, like, on purpose, responded with the incorrect name of the person that was calling me incorrect names, just so they could understand what it was like to be called by a name that's not your name. But I just thought it was just, like, it was a little bit funny, but then it just kind of got a little bit annoying that people would tell him the right name and then he wouldn't respond with the right name when, like, this whole season he's been annoyed that people can't get his name right. So, whatever.
I understand that. I spent 8 years being called Mia.
Yeah. Predictions? I think just Mara's just spot on. It's just, you know, she's read this season like a book, and the whole Thawne is going to betray you. It's going to come out, and, you know, we can't, like, Barry's going to be like, I told y'all. And we can't say anything about it because he did, and I saw it coming, so.
And he will be right, and it'll be the first time to be like, yeah. That's
yeah. Very
I think Sherlock will finally get his, you know, happy ending with Irene. And then, is her name Irene Adler? Whatever. And then he'll leave for good, so good riddance. And I'm not sure how, but defeating Cicada, I feel like it's somehow tied into Thawne breaking out of prison. Like, that's probably why he secretly orchestrated the whole thing. But I'm not sure how that's going to work, if it does, if that is, like, the truth. And then, because I'm hopeful, I think Sisko will realize he still wants to be Vibe and that he can have a normal life. Though if he decides to leave the team, I can honestly see Carlos dropping to recurring in season 6. But I'm not even mention, or I will, that Jeremy Jordan did the same thing, and then we never saw him again. So let me know.
I do think that you're on to something with, like, the Grace, Kata, and Thawne, because for me, like, she seems to know way too much about certain things that, even though she's from the future, like, how does she know where and when the cryo-atomizer is so that she can steal it? How does she know that there are prototypes of the drug in Caitlin's father's lab or whatever without some help? So, like, I feel like Thawne had to tell her, push her to go back into the past. Like, the whole time, the whole plot up until her, you know, from the point where she breaks into the past with Thawne's time was just all him, just in his real plan is when she came back into the past. And I think the fact that she keeps popping in at certain times, specific times, to steal specific things, to make a specific weapon that Nora has to specifically stop, is a little too specific, if you know what I mean.
The most specific. Alright, are we good to move on to legends?
We are.
Okay. Egg MacGuffin. While Ray is worried about Nora, he is suddenly faced with his own problem that forces him to do the unthinkable. Nate and Zarya are stuck in an awkward limbo, so Sarah devises a plan to send them on an easy mission together. Meanwhile, Charlie and Rory are approached with a lucrative offer that could upend their lives, until Mona comes and ruins it. Chris Tomorrow directed the episode written by James Egan and Tyrone B. Carter. What did we like?
I love the follow-up from last episode being Sarah making more of an effort to do things that Ava likes. She really put in the work and tried to read that book in one day. And I thought that the part about the doormat tied nicely into both Gary's story, the adventure subplot, and to Mick's books. That was clever. And I thought the reveal of Ava not even reading the books, but just wanting Sarah to join the book club was really funny and cute, as was their betting on whether or not Nate and Zarya would hook up during their team up. I was Team Ava in that instance. And I also really liked the Mick subplot this week, which is saying a lot because I usually don't even like Mick, and he doesn't often have a subplot. The continuity of his writing leading to the publication of his books under a pseudonym, which was actually really great, and I liked his shenanigans with Charlie. It seems the writers like his dynamic with Macy in general, and always tend to pair them up. And then him teaching her how to be him and get inside his head was really fun. And then when he embraced his author identity in front of a room full of fans, felt more or less earned and turned out to be like a really nice moment for him. And I also laughed a lot during Charlie's impression of fake Rebecca Silver, even though it was completely made up. The air of arrogance she had was really great. And then unexpectedly, I really did like Gary's subplot and development as well. Like, he has always really been the doormat when it comes to everything and everyone on the show. He's mistreated, he's talked down to, he's ignored, and then Neron preying on those negative feelings worked really well. Like, who knew his missing nipple would come back into play?
Such a gross, but fulfilling way.
MVP of the episode was Brandon Ralph for playing the warring factions of Ray and Neron so well. Like, I could really feel how conflicted and scared he was and how badly he fought to protect his friends from harm before willingly giving in. So poor Ray really didn't want to kill his bro, Nate. I also thought it was really clever that they included the idea that Neron needs some kind of permission to take over fully, but that he makes it so he always ends up getting what he wants one way or another.
I've also loved the doormat theme, and in particular how it tied to Gary. When Sarah made the revelation about the book and described to Ava about the doormat being the killer, I was thinking, like, well, that sounds a lot like someone we know. And then the shot immediately cut to Gary. I was like, I see you, show. I see where we're going here. So I really liked that, even though at that point we didn't know how Gary's doormat situation would tie into the episode. I thought the Golden Egg episode subplot was kind of lame. That was the more obvious doormat situation because we saw in the beginning how, you know, Vincent did all the work and then his boss got all the credit. So I thought, like, the whole, you know, actually that whole subplot was lame, even with, like, the date and the just getting the magical creature. But that aside, I really liked the Neron plot, doormat plot, and how Neron recruits Gary to join him. And I feel like the dismissal and disregard of Gary is often played for laughs. There's always played for laughs in the show, and it's been funny in the past. But you do like stop to think about it, and you like stop to think about how often it happens to Gary. No one on the Legends crew or Ava really at the Bureau really treats Gary very nicely or gives him much of a second thought, even though he goes above and beyond for them. Like, even just last week when Ava was stuck in purgatory, and Gary's like, "Oh my God, I'm here for you, Ava," and has like, you know, decorates the entire room with, like, candles and plants and just going above and beyond for Ava. And we've seen him, like, show up for Legends countless times. And just, it's never reciprocated. And he's never appreciate it. And it just feels like the first time the show's actually decided to address that and use it as a story and frame it in a way that makes sense when you see when Gary does what he does. I felt really bad because I could see like Gary's heart kind of break when Ray, the nicest of all legends, he's like the nicest person on the legends, blurts out that his soul would still be safe even if Gary died because Ray didn't love him. Like that, like, if Ray does not love you and he's the nicest of the legends, like, what does that really mean for you? So I really felt heartbroken for Gary in that revelation in that moment. And, like, that really hurt me, like, all the way on the other side of the TV screen, you know, just seeing Gary, like, react to that. And I was almost expecting Neron to body jump to Gary because I'm pretty sure that Gary would have been, like, a willing host at that moment when he hears that. So, like, at first, I was a little bit disappointed when Ray gave in to Neron, or, like, later in the episode, to keep him from killing Nate, which, sidetrack, the whole, like, Ray trying to save Nate and Nate not understanding what's happening in the episode was also great. Like, all the times that Ray was trying to, like, push him away, sometimes even, like, violently, because Neron was taking over, and Nate just being, like, you know, so unwilling to believe that Ray could do that and wondering what's happening and still trying to reach out to Ray. And then all of that kind of, like, culminating into, you know, Nate not even fighting back when Ray is, like, punching him in the face. Even though he's, like, literally made of steel, and he's just allowing, like, Ray to punch him. And then Ray giving up for Nate, I thought was really great scene between them. But going back to the whole Gary of it all, I would have preferred, at first I would have preferred that Neron, like, body jumped to Gary because I thought it would have been, like, a great story. But the fact that Ray gives in to Neron to save Nate, and then Neron still recruits Gary by offering to make him whole again with that little, like, really gross, like, nipple actually, like, moving was super gross. But giving him his nipple back and having that be Gary join the dark side was, I thought, really well done. So, and the only other reason that I'm not too disappointed that Neron took over Ray is because Brandon Routh is just excellent, and I think he makes a great evil guy, and it really just feels like he's being allowed to perform his entire range of abilities. And even, like, especially in this episode, everything from his, like, physical comedy, trying to, like, control his arm from Neron, and how he switches from soft puppy Ray to evil demon Neron in his, like, expressions, facial expressions, his tone, all while having a conversation with himself and or other people was all really, really good. So definitely MVP for me as well. Ava Lance book club was also really sweet and funny. I thought it was hilarious that Sarah was, like, she's, like, bending over backwards because she knows that she's had this, like, relationship therapy with Ava in the previous episode. So she's trying to be her best, be, like, the best girlfriend ever and find a way to finish this dumbass book that she finds out that she actually really enjoys in the book club, only to find out that Ava only joins book club for wine and nonsense. It was really funny. And Jess McCallan, I'm sure it was Mad Lib, but Jess McCallan, like, raising a glass for Nora to, like, clink with was, like, a brilliant user ad lib. I love that. It was really, really cute. And I like that for once Ava isn't that serious, like, book club, she just wants to, like, shut off her brain and, like, listen to Mona, like, spew nonsense all the time. It was, like, a really nice side of Ava that you hadn't seen before. And then finally, while I shall resist Nate Zari to my last breath, even more than Brainia, but Brainia is actually cute. Nate Zari is testing me, but... It's testing me, I'll say that. But they follow the hell out of the rom-com date trope book with such scenes as, oh no, we both have to hide in this tiny-ass closet, which we're close enough to kiss, but don't.
Excellent. So,
like, you know, out of my control, I did fall victim to some of their antics. Like the tripwires to get the egg, and Zari thinking that she had to do it because, therefore, objectification, because that's always happens in movies. Only to have me be like, hold my beer, and him being the actual one to do it, and ultimately being objectified by Zari, like, while he, like, contorted in these, like, ridiculous positions, and, like, pushing his ass out, and all that kind of stuff, to get through the wires. I thought that was funny. But, like, as a sweet moment, the final
was like really made me fall. The writers like went out of their way and used up all of the good mojo they had to make me feel something for this episode. I don't think I'll feel it again, but I did think that one scene was really sweet.
That scene I liked. Yeah. Your name, sorry.
Yeah. One scene only.
Overall, I thought Brandon Routh did an amazing job this episode. He made the war for Rey's soul be both hilarious and terrifying. He played Neron really well. And also, there was, like, a lot of comedy in the moments of dealing with Nate and Gary. But also, especially with Nate, like, the bromance shined through. Like, we see that he really does not want to hurt Nate. So it was believable when he sacrificed his soul to save Nate. So all that worked really well, I thought. Also, like, the initial realization from when he almost killed Nora with a pillow was also really well done. And I was like, whoa! I also liked how they brought back the, like, coming out of the mirror. Like, Nora did that when she was talking to Nate, and then, you know, the Neron part of Nate is also in the mirror, so that was good. Echoing all of your thoughts about Gary, I thought it was really, it was great the way that they flipped the dynamic with Gary. Like you said, we've always seen Gary as comedic relief. He's the butt of every joke. He's about monkey the show. And then they actually made that relevant in this episode, because it does chip away at a person's self-esteem to always be like the least favorite, to always be the one that is mocked. And so that would leave someone more susceptible to a thing like demonic possession. And also, it's like a nice comparison to Nora, who has become strong enough to reject Neron thanks to the struggle she went through last season, as well as her father's sacrifice for her and Rey's belief in her, etc. So you see how two very different years can affect someone's reaction to the Neron. The nipple horror show was nasty, but the perfectly on brand for the show. That's the kind of like body humor that I would expect from them. And they managed to make it work with Gary's story. So there you go. You know, like, who wouldn't want their nipple back? The Charlie and Nick part of the Rebecca Silver plotline was great. I really enjoyed their dynamic, them working together. I've always loved Dominic and Maisie's chemistry, and then here it's different when it's Charlie, but it still works. It still makes them, they're better together, I guess. Or really, Charlie's always great, but Nick is certainly better with Charlie. Also, I liked how her dismissiveness of the situation was curbed by the realization that Nick actually cares about his work and also about his readers, which was one of, like, the first sparks of humanity or real character depth that we've seen from Mick in years, but also from Charlie in, like, weeks. So, like, ever since the show came back, we haven't really gotten much story for her. And this time we actually, you know, it's nice to see her in an actual subplot instead of just, like, on the side of a subplot commenting on it.
Like, sucking up all the air in the room.
Yes. And, yes, because Nora hasn't been talking, Mona hasn't been talking about the air in the room, which we will get to soon. What did we not like about this episode?
That's me. no matter how cute it was to watch Ava and Sarah bet on whether or not Nate and Zarya would get together on their mission, I disliked most of the subplot, besides the one that you previously mentioned about, like, her kissing away his bruises. That was really sweet. But as hard as it is to say, I don't like how they're pushing this relationship, even though I usually enjoy all the fun romance tropes that they use in this episode, so I feel like it was wasted on me, personally. It's been going on for, like, 3 or 4 episodes straight at this point, and I think it's derailed a lot of, some of the plot, at least, and it has pushed aside other characters for it, which is frustrating. And I'm glad that Zari is able to come to terms with the fact that she isn't forthcoming with her feelings, but I don't like that they avoided that maybe her family being killed was the reason for that. I also found it strange that Nate would end up on a mission and not really question it, especially considering he's no longer part of the Legends. Like, he hasn't been on a mission or on the Wave Rider in a long time. And it's really a bit ridiculous that Sarah would send them both on a mission alone just so they could sort out whatever is going on between them. And then the mission itself, I thought it was, like, the weakest part of the episode and didn't feel as fun as previous missions have been. all in all, I'm not personally feeling this romantic relationship and the length they're going through to rush it before the end of the season. Like, I'm starting to wonder why. I don't know who it was, but, you know, mentioning that Zari might leave scares me.
No!
Yeah. I'd rather have, like, Zari sort out on her own without constant, like, her feelings on her own, rather than have people constantly suggesting to her what it is she should do or what, you know, she should say from the peanut gallery. So that's annoying. And then as a side note, I honestly thought they were going to play really heavily into Dark Adam relationship all season, but somehow that got switched to Nate and Zari becoming the beta ship of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. And then there's Mona, who, as a character I want to like, but can't a lot of the time. I think, especially in this episode, like, her overreacting at Romanticon was too much, and I still wonder how she fits into the Wave Rider, and more specifically, in the season and the show as a whole, considering I feel like there's nothing left for her. They're not really writing anything for her after the whole Kunane thing, so I don't know what's going to happen there.
Yeah, I feel like, I honestly thought Mona was fine this episode, right up until the point where she freaks out at Romanticon and gets upset to the point of almost, like, wolfing out in front of a whole crowd of people. And I struggle, like, I really struggle to say, not to say that I find her annoying, because annoying is a label that's, like, far too generously thrown around onto female characters without cause, like, just because, like, I don't like her, so she's annoying. But Mona is kind of annoying. And I feel like, you know, she's so far removed from her original character description that we got in the beginning, like, before the season started, of who Ramona Young, or I think at that time her name was, like, Alaska Young, who this character was supposed to be, that I don't even know what her purpose is. And the only thing that kind of anchored her to any kind of story at all, which is the magical creatures at the Bureau, specifically Fanane, he's dead, and she can't go back to the Bureau, so she just feels like a plastic bag, adrift in the wind, floating whimsically with no real purpose. And yeah, and she's the Legends Gary. But the thing is, the Legends don't need a Gary, because all of them in their own ways are already slightly ridiculous. So they don't really need an even more ridiculous character on the ship. The Bureau is so straight laced and serious that wacky characters like Gary, like Mona, and low key Nate makes sense there, because they balance out the overall tone of the show. So Mona over in the Bureau is more watchable than Mona trying to fit in with the Legends team. I really can't see her sticking around past this season. I don't really know that she's that big of a character fandom-wise, or like a fan favorite. I can't see her being a fan favorite, to be honest. So I don't really understand. I don't see how she would have longevity past this season. So if she is a this season character, there should be a purpose for her this season. And if there is a purpose for the Legends having to babysit her as a magical creature, I hope it reveals itself in the next few episodes, because I just don't know why she's still here, to be honest. I don't know. They need to figure out what they're trying to do for Mona, because I just don't understand. I don't see it at this point. And then while in spite of myself, I did find Nate and Zari entertaining at some points of this episode. Like I mentioned earlier, the egg plot was the least entertaining plot of the episode. It was just the weakest link. And then with Nate and Zari specifically, it's really bothering me that almost everyone on the Wave Rider seems to be pressuring Zari, like, not to date Nate. They're not like, go get to know him, say you want to go on a date, but they're specifically like, have sex with me. Like, fuck me. Like, literally. And, you know, like, this episode, it was, like, Sarah continuing to, like, equate Zari's feelings with sex made me feel, like, uncomfortable for Zari. Just, like, saying that, you know, it's about sex and about boning Nate. It just kind of makes me feel like, Sarah, aren't you in, like, a whole-ass functioning relationship? Like, why not have some of that kind of conversation instead of just talking about, like, sex, the sexual aspect of it? And I feel like if I were to just unclench and accept that Nate and Zari is going to happen, because it's happening, the constant equating of dating to just a physical sexual relationship makes me think the writers, as I already suspect, don't actually care about the ship at all. Which, if this is the case, that they don't care about the ship and they're only using
using it as a plot device. Why are we even doing it? Because, as I've mentioned several times before, no one asked for this particular fan fiction. Like, no one asked for this. So, why are we doing it? So, I think, like, that is really bothering me specifically, that it's the push for Zari, even if it's the plot device for Zari to open up about her feelings about losing her family, and that's why she's so closed off. The push for her to be with Nate is about sex and not about, like, opening herself up to having feelings for someone else. And that, it rubs me the wrong way that Zari being in a relationship, the focus is so much on her needing to get laid as opposed to actually talking about her feelings. And while I like that Zari's like, no, Sarah, I don't need that kind of advice. Please stop. It just keeps coming back, not only from Sarah, but from other legends as well. So, I don't know. I don't like that.
I also don't like that. But I'm, like, not really, like, I feel like, yeah, that's just, like, not, like, a reflection of the characterization so much as just, like, that's how the Legends writers imagine that Sarah would talk about romance, which is, like...
Like a whole... romance of her own, so it's kind of really weird that her views wouldn't have, like, evolved.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but I feel like it's just kind of like a shallow way of being like, of getting jokes out of
a
Sarah conversation. And I don't like that, like, for what it says about Sarah. Or what it says about their view of Sarah. Because I forgot to mention that I really did like you guys mentioned, I liked Sarah wanting to read that book. And, you know, like, wanting, like, putting the effort in to make Ava feel good and how she started off, like, struggling to concentrate. And then once she did, it turned out she really liked it. I liked that. Slightly less believable is that Ava would find it comforting to listen to Mona babble about anything, but perhaps that's just proof, again, that Ava is not like us other humans because
she wasn't listening. She, like, never listened. That's actually pretty accurate.
I just think about whatever. I'm just like,
her blind daydream.
Yeah. She's like, can you just, like, babble in silence while I think about other things? Thank you. But anyway, Mona, I I've been struggling with Mona for a very long time, but since the dawn of time, really. But I didn't, her little interrupting the whole Nick and Charlie thing was so unnecessary, and just shows, I mean, she really only thinks about her own perspective, because it's like, she doesn't know what was going on with that. Like, maybe they really were doing it for a reason. You know, maybe that was part of submission, but instead she was like, so whatever. And yes, like you said, like her being about
Rebecca Silver about as much as she knows Jane Austen,
right? Exactly. And her about to wolf out in front of everyone, like whatever. Just okay. She just needs to get herself under control because she's ridiculous. Anyway, I thought that the majority of the wild goose chase. Egg MacGuffin. the MacGuffin of the episode was kind of, like, lame and, like, weird, and I don't know. So, yeah, I thought it was fun the way that Zari and Nate went through the tropes and then, like, sidestepped some of them, but for the whole episode to kind of be based around that was, again, like, I guess it was supposed to offset some of the demonic possession, but Ray was already doing that with comedic elements in that story, so we didn't need, like, an extra super lighthearted thing. Not to mention, you know, of course, Charlie and Nate were also doing that. So whatever, it's just there to put Nate and Zari together, and that's fine for people that like it, that's great, but it wasn't like anyone was anticipating it before it happened, you know? It's not like it's not a plot device, it's not a romance that they have been dropping hints for that would then make this feel like a payoff when we're finally getting that storyline.
Sure.
Something that would feel like a payoff, like you already said, would have been Dark Adam if we were actually getting some, and considering that this is like perfect Dark Adam material, you know, Ray is possessed because he was trying to save Nora, but
instead we get romance.
In the first place, that's perfect fodder for a Dark Adam plot, for Nora to save him with the power of love, etc., but we don't know if that certainly wasn't happening here. We don't know if it will happen in the future. And I don't think we even know if Courtney Ford will be a regular next season or not.
I don't think we know that yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, hopefully she will. And hopefully we'll actually get payoff for Dark Adam.
I thought it was kind of a letdown that, you know, Ray's whole dilemma is killing someone he loves and trying to do that, and then he thinks that would be like a Dark Adam setup, but actually it's like
one would think.
Ray is everything. All the romances. The Ray romance,
yes.
And the Zari romance.
He's a romance with Ray, he's a romance with Zari.
Yeah. So that was a little bit blah. But yeah, that's my feelings. So, what do we predict?
I got nothing.
Yeah.
Like, what do we think? If there's like two demons, right? There's Ray and Gary? Yeah.
Oh, well, Gary.
Well, Tabitha. Gary's Tabitha, right?
Gary isn't Tabitha. He's just missing to a demon.
Who is Tabitha going to be then? Will Tabitha come out?
I don't know. Like, I feel like it'd still be the best guess would be Nora, since it would be like Dark Adam. But I don't even know if Tabitha is coming anymore.
Knowing this show, though, it'll probably be Zari and Nate has to save her.
Oh, God.
Protect our daughter. Okay.
Neutral. Oops. All right, 1 second.
I understand why you forgot about it, though, because no one...
No one wrote anything, so we have nothing to say. Moving on. Okay, Doom Patrol. It was called Cyborg Patrol. Cyborg Patrol!
Cyborg.
Exactly. We are all excited. With Vic captured by the Bureau of Normalcy and being held at the ant farm, his father, Silas Stone, hatches a plan to break him out with the rest of the Doom Patrol. As you can imagine, not everything goes according to plan. What would it be like?
Who wants to start?
Jess, it's your turn to go first.
Cyber Patrol, I like that we finally get an episode centered around Cyborg, or at least saving Cyborg, because I think we talked about last week that so much of Doom Patrol has focused on every other character other than Cyborg. And the last time that we actually got an episode centered on him was his introduction in episode 2. So it was nice that we finally got back around to him and the whole crux of his situation being that he can't trust his not only his father, but his own pet. I really liked it because I thought last week I was like, no one's going to remember Cyborg until the end. It's going to suck. So I do like that Jane actually did bring up to the Doom Patrol that this is happening, and that they decided that they wanted to do something about that. They weren't going to do, like, clipping and just, like, leave him there and hope it all works out for the best. So thank you for that. I think that particularly in this episode, I like that the two ladies, I like that Jane and Rita, both were really Cyborg's defenders and stood up for him and explained the situation to Larry and to Cliff. So I like that. In the past couple episodes, one with he shares his story with Rita, and then in the previous episode where he shares his story with Jane, and how those both paid off with these ladies kind of being like his biggest supporters and going to save him, and why they should not trust Silas, and both of them trying to protect him, not only rescue him from the ant farm, but also protect him from his father and from Grid. I really liked both of them and their roles in this episode. I liked that we got to see inside the ant farm because it was another like weird situation. Just getting to see like that part of the universe and the Bureau of Normalcy and what they're actually about, and how they use these quote unquote oddities like 722. You don't really know what he does, but I like that the little reveal that he could hear Grid talking to Cyborg when Cyborg wasn't really sure if he was there or not. And so you get kind of a glimpse of what his powers could be, but you also see how life is in the Bureau of Normalcy and how you're kind of locked in this empty box and you get little rewards for doing whatever missions, but they're so like messed up that this guy can't even remember half the time like what his name is or when he was there and how long he's been there. So it's kind of scary at the same time, because you see that Vic is in this position, and since he offloaded Grid from his system, he's just kind of in a like a boat without a paddle, just out dead in the water. He can't really even help what's going on with the situation. So he's kind of this whole time been thinking about, you know, what it means to be cyborg and how much of his personality is wrapped up in his tech. And now that he doesn't have that and he can't really save himself from the situation, so it's kind of, it was really interesting to see that kind of internal struggle. And then you have the added horror that Grid reinstalled itself in a cyborg. The scary situation of his tech, like he can't even control his tech anymore. So even like making the decision to cut himself off from Grid, he can't even separate himself because Grid somehow is like reinstalling itself and doing things without Cyborg's permission, without Vic's permission. So that whole thing was very scary to kind of watch unfurl, and Grid is becoming more and more ominous. And I do have a prediction about that. If it's going where I think it's going, it's going to be really scary and kind of a good payoff. But I liked all of that. I liked that Silas immediately knows something is wrong and kind of like bursts into the Doom Patrol house looking for his son. And the Doom Patrol, the one like funny line, like Calista snitches get stitches, and then like a Larry like immediately snitches that the ant farm has his son, and seeing like Silas go through the whole thing of, you know, trying to first use his power of influence, and when that fails, coming up with the plan to break into the Doom Patrol, and then the whole like fake out of whether Silas is actually good or bad, because when you see that, you know, they break into the Doom Patrol under the pretext of bringing like an oddity. They break into the ant farm, sorry, and then the kind of reveal that the Bureau of Normalcy knew they were coming and thought that Silas was doing a deal, and then the whole like reverse reveal that it was actually all part of the plan, and Jane being the linchpin of that plan and helping free the rest of the Doom Patrol, and then them going to get Cyborg. Yeah, Rita.
Who did I say?
Jane.
Oh,
yeah. It's because Jane took over with Karen, and then Rita was like, "I'm the linchpin. It's me."
Is that because I really thought like Rita, because Rita's the only one that has sense. Like, you don't need to do this. And so when she didn't show up, I was like, "Where is Rita?" And then you find out that like Cliff has to like throw up Rita. I was like, "Oh, that's kind of gross." But it's also kind of cool how that all plan came together. And I did think that Jane, momentarily transforming into Karen and turning that. Because, like, when the guy was going to torture Jane, I'm like, oh, this is going to be good because, you know, he just has no idea what he's in for. And then he turned to Karen and was like, oh, fuck. But the fact that even that kind of worked out, I thought all of that played out really, really well. And then the final scene with Vic and his dad and all the memories of his mom was well acted, but there's a lot of issues that I have with that I'll save for the dislikes.
Yeah, I actually really liked Silas throughout this episode, because I think that this entire season he's kind of been treated like a lot like a villain, sometimes even more so than Mr. Nobody, because they forget Mr. Nobody exists half the time, other than he kidnapped Chief. So Silas is like the living, breathing, oh, we can hate this guy because of what he's done to Cyborg. So I like the fact that he did know there was something going on with Vic. He did come to the Doom Patrol for help, and then they worked out a plan to get him out of there by making it seem like tricking the audience into thinking he was actually like a bad guy, and then reversing that, which was really clever. And
it's a great area, so it was nice to like play into that heavily, so you don't even know what Silas' true endgame is until the end.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it was really nice to have the Doom Patrol work with him, because I like Jane and Rita kind of being like, no, we're not going to trust this guy because of what he's done to Vic. So I like how protective they were of him, so that they didn't want to like work immediately with him. But then they're like, well, we don't really have much of a choice anyway. And I really like that, because Vic is kind of like, he has been the de facto team lead. And now that he's gone, it's really nice to see them all rallying together to try to break him out, even though it makes Rita really uncomfortable. but she'd do it anyway. And then I really like the fact that Silas did prove that he does love his son. and he wanted to help him. That was a really nice moment. And then Mr. Nobody revealing, like, his manipulation of Cyborg was really terrifying and tragic. I think Rita swooping in to save the day and the team, you know, willing to put their lives on the line, like I said, and then her just kind of being the linchpin, like you said, Jess. I really like the internal struggle as well for Vic. Like, the lack of control he's been feeling over the last few episodes has been building up, and now that he's, like, locked in a room, it kind of came to the forefront for him. Like, he was not only out of, everything was out of his control, like, with grid and everything, but he was out of his, what's the word I'm looking for here? It was, like, he couldn't control his own situation physically. Like, he couldn't leave the room. And I thought that was really well done. I liked the initial break-in to the ant farm. And the really creepy control ladies, or whatever the hell they were, that was really...
Yeah,
that was super creepy and kind of showcased, like, how awful the ant farm really was and what they were willing to go. And how many people they even had, like, locked up. It was really creepy.
Oh my god, the butts.
The butts, Rita calling out of Cliff's mouth. That was all disgusting. but just in general, I'm glad that we finally got an episode where it did kind of focus on Vic, even though there's also problems with, or issues with how that was portrayed. But those are, like, the main things that I liked about the episode. I'm struggling to remember a lot of it. I watched it too early.
It happens sometimes. So, yes, I liked that we got an episode that's finally looking at, you know, the internal aspects of Vic, of what Cyborg's going through, and that we got the rest of the team actively concerned about him. And so, once again, it's like, oh, Cyborg really does matter. I also liked how Rita and Jane wanted to, like, respect Vic's wishes and not introduce Silas. Whereas Larry was like, okay, well, we're not going to get him out, otherwise we got to bring him. Like, we can only get him out with that one guy who hasn't been on the show since, like, episode 3, or Silas. And then, of course, Silas resolved that issue by just barging in anyway. And yes, Robot Man's reaction when he was like, Stitches was hilarious. Also, I just really loved, I really liked Silas' episode, and I liked how this was, like, the reverse of the error reveal. Where first you're like, oh my god, traitor, he's gonna turn them in, and then it was like, haha, I had a plan all along. I guess it's kind of like the Nora thing, right? You're like, oh my god, what's Nora doing? Oh, she's doing this. But this is like, you know, Cyborg's dad seems like he knows what is going on and, like, could actually succeed. So, it's a little less unbelievable.
Reverse betrayal of the week.
Yes, it's true. It was the week of reverse betrayals. But yeah, so I liked that they were all in on that plan, and they were all, like, expecting to get captured and tortured for Vic. So that was nice. Yeah. And I liked, like, how the different stories played out. Like, first, Cliff being the one that was, like, most concerned about the kind of torture and experimentation that would go on, and then instead he finds out that he's not that interesting. He's just a brain of a brain in a tin box. He's like, wait a second, I'm very interesting. I got primitive. Play the experiment on me. So that was fun. And then, like, Larry's was really, like, because obviously he's the one that has the most, you know, fear. He would have the most fear because he's already been in that position. He's already been captured by them. And yet the fact that he was willing to go in for Vic shows growth on his part. And he was separated from Negative Man, but then at the end he does pick Negative, you know, his other half back up to, like, take it with him. And he could have easily just left it there. So I was like, that's nice. More growth for Larry. James was awesome. I love what the guy is. He's like, bitch, you took my arm or whatever.
Yes,
the ink blot. And then she's like, yeah, I know you've seen Groundhog Day or whatever. It wasn't Groundhog Day. It was the other one. Whatever, doesn't matter. When he was playing the song, he was playing Ace of Base. Preparing to torture her. And so they're never
Discount Dexter.
Yes, Discount Dexter. And there never was any torturing because he was too busy, like, with the prep. So I love that. And then I loved how their favorite, like, their favorite, was it their favorite book, was Fault in Our Stars?
Yeah.
Once her song played. So, yeah, that whole thing was great. Plus, Rita being the one who didn't want to be part of the plan, and then becoming the linchpin of the plan, and getting mad that Jane was stealing her spotlight because of Karen. But I also like, you know, even though Karen's, like, psycho, like, obviously she and Jane were working together. Maybe not that they were working together, but Jane has enough control at this point that Karen came out at just the right time to stop him, and then Jane came back when Karen could have easily, you know, like, turned him against them. Mm-hmm. He became Jane again, like it was planned out. So I like that. And then what I also liked was this and this one, it worked. Like, when I was saying, like, there was too much nonsense in the Legends episode, in this one, like, Vic's story is so bleak, and, like, it's so upsetting to watch him having to struggle with, like, not having any control, like, first off, not knowing who his father really is or what his father wants for him, and then not even having control over his own body because there's, you know, the cybernetics inside of him are still, like, working without his consent. So all of that is, like, horrifying enough that it worked really well to have the sort of escape romp to save him be really lighthearted. So I like that. I thought that was a nice balance. And that he was also, like, following the different tropes, like, even, like, oh, let's release all the weirdos, right? It's going to be like a... So, yeah, all of that was great. And then you have the very serious side of it, which is what Vic is going through. Even his little roommate, 722 or whatever, like, the reveal that man's been in there, like, so long. Like, it's, like, been, like, 50 years that he's been in there. So then for Vic to cause, like, that could be him. You know, this could be happening to him. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and all that, like, the growth, like, first when he doesn't believe that it's real, like, he doesn't believe that any of this is really happening, right? It's just a hallucination until his roommate also hears it. And then that also feeds into him believing the vision is real when his dad comes in. And right. When his dad's, oh, the plan, we're going to upload the grid again. And then he sees that scene of his father putting the nanites purposefully in his body, which makes him lose control. So all of that worked really well together, even though it was very upsetting to watch. And also, I mean, I think, like, if there was going to be a time where Mr. Nobody popped back up again to be like, ah, it was me, this is probably the most dramatic moment he could have done it. So I guess that was good, you know?
That was flair for the dramatic.
Yeah. Even though, obviously, I have displeasure about some of that. But anyway, so there, that's what I liked. What did we not like?
Well, I will say first, before I go into the dislikes, I did like that the Bureau of Normalcy thought that they got a good get when they got Cyborg. But the fact that he had already offloaded his grid and then he was having all these internal struggles, they are, like, pissed that they can't get anything out of Cyborg. I thought it served them right. But as for what I did not like, I should be careful or at least be, like, more specific in my wish list when I say I want a Cyborg-focused episode. Because this one was pretty painful, just, you know, watching him struggle and not really know what's real and what's not real, and so much of it was him not being in control. And then I like that ever since the beginning, we've always seen Silas as a great character because we've seen him through the lens of Vic and the fact that he's overprotective, and we see, you know, all these little episodes, things that Silas has done, like taking away the jet and then giving back the jet when he overhears, you know, Vic having a conversation with Rita back in, like, episode, like, 3 or whatever. And so you see all these kind of ways he's controlling and how he's not necessarily telling the truth. And then you have, like, the added, you know, mystery of Vic's memories of how his mother died and, you know, who's really at fault for that. And this nobody's been playing not only with Vic's mind, but also our minds, like, all season long about where Silas stands on this spectrum. And I liked that even in this episode, we didn't really know where Silas stood, but I didn't like that in the end, when you see, like, it's all been building up for, like, in this, like, pressure cooker for Vic in this entire episode. He's already in this, like, small room, and then he's locked inside of his own mind with Grid, uploading stuff without his consent, and replaying all of these memories about, like, his mom dying,
and slowly, like, it seems like there's, like, some kind of, like, virus going on where all of his memories are being, like, corrupted, and, that even in the reveal that of Silas using the nanites and knowing that these nanites could hurt Vic, and the when his assistant says, she wouldn't do this, and he's like, so? And that's what kind of triggers Vic to go over the edge and basically, like, pummel his father to what I assume is death, and then have that be the moment that Mr. Nobody shows up, like, surprise! You're on top! You know, and just be like, you know, I did this, and, you know, for a character that's already, he's gone from, even in this episode, it's like, part of the story is, this is Cyborg. You can't do this to Cyborg. Cyborg's an actual hero. You can't do this to him. And actually, yeah, they could do this to him. They did do it to him. And now you have Mr. Nobody actually, like, piling onto that. Not only has Vic inadvertently killed his mom, he's also now inadvertently killed his dad, who was actually a good guy, who was actually trying to help him without any kind of shady or underhandedness. And now Vic is responsible for the death of both of his parents, and it's just, like, really fucked up. And I hope that Silas is just, like, in a coma or unconscious or whatever, because I can't. That's not what I wanted. That is not what I wanted. It's just, it's not like this. It's definitely very dramatic narratively, but I just don't, like, how does, you know, I just feel like it's going to get very dark, even darker for Vic than it is now, and I don't like it.
I completely agree with that. But before I get to that, I guess I just wanted this episode to be more of what we got with Jane Patrol. Like, I feel like this could have split into two episodes. So we could have gotten this whole episode where we got Vic to explore what was happening with him, what's triggering him, maybe flashbacks to actually what happened to his mother, because we just keep seeing the same scene over and over again.
Right.
And just more background into his relationship with his father prior to, like, Mr. Nobody's review. And then in the second episode, or part two or whatever, it could have focused on the rescue mission, because I feel like that took up a large chunk of the episode, and that took away from exploration of whatever was going on with Vic. And with regards to, like, him pummeling his dad, that was really hard to watch. And also, I just feel like Jess said, he's been living in this gray area for so long, but I don't feel like there was enough build up to that moment, other than this episode where it was just like, okay, your dad's, like, a really shitty person, so, like, let's just beat the shit out of him.
Guys, he actually loved you.
Yeah, right? Like, that's just really terrible. So I also hope
that was awful.
Yeah, I also hope that he's still alive. But yeah, I could have done with less of the rescue mission and just more of Vic, because I don't think it was a proper exploration of, like, him as a person, because he is already the least developed character story-wise of this entire team, and even in this episode he got shortchanged, which is really frustrating. So that's, like, my biggest pet peeve about this entire thing, is I wanted more, and we got more of, like, the team doing their thing, which is great, but I feel like it really could have benefited from more of Vic and less of them.
I feel like, as an audience, at least we should have gotten more. Like, if Vic doesn't know what's going on, fine. But, you know, we've seen that same clip over and over again. I wish I at least knew, like, definitively whether it was real or not. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, from the beginning, there's just something off about that memory, that it can't be real. But, and I get, like, maybe they don't want to show it because it also kind of, like, shortchanges the mystery of, like, Vic's, you know, situation. It makes him beating his father to death even more tragic, knowing that whole situation. But I don't know. I just feel like I agree with you that we keep getting the same information on Vic, and we don't know what's going on, and Vic doesn't know what's going on, but it's just kind of, like, too much tension.
Yeah, and they already tease, like, Mr. Nobody messing with his mind, like, in one of the first episodes with regards to that memory. But yeah, it's just like we could have used a whole lot more, because it's just regurgitation at this
point. I totally agree with that.
basically, I agree with that. I think that they're relying too much on the same beats when it comes to Cyborg, when it comes to what Vic is going through. And I don't know if it's because they don't have more or because they're holding it back for, like, some other reason.
I think they're holding it back for, like, the finale, and that's just, like, too long.
Yeah, like, it's not necessary. Like, there's going to be somewhere else to go even once we, you know, like, yeah, like, sure, maybe we don't learn the truth of what happened with his mother yet, but there's no reason why we can't see more of the dynamic, like, what was working his mother like that would make this incident so, you know, like, that would give us clues as to why this can't be real or whatever, you know?
Correct.
That would be nice. Also, I do think that considering that it was Cyborg's big episode, they could have spent a little longer on him in the episode. Not everyone else needed to have their little escape stories presented, considering that plenty of other episodes go by with only a few characters getting spotlight, and not everyone. So it's like, oh, now that it's Cyborg's episode, suddenly everyone has to get spotlight. And yeah, I mean, also the butts. I didn't think the butts were funny. I didn't think
that's very ridiculous. I agree with that.
They were ridiculous, and also like I didn't understand that Bureau of Normalcy dude, like first like dude who just like loves his Burger King, Big Mac, yeah, McDonald's, whatever it was.
And he's the general. He's supposed to be the top person, and yeah. I don't like he shouldn't be in like when the
right
oddities that they lock up.
Yeah. Like, it seemed like something happened to him.
Yeah.
And I was supposed to, like, wonder about it, but they didn't, unless it was connected to the butts, you know, they didn't give us any explanations. So it was just kind of like, okay.
And then he killed himself. So
and then he killed himself.
Just your, right. What's your purpose, guy?
Yeah. Just, it was like, it's like it was meant to be, like, to increase the quote-unquote humor of the man-eating butts. But it wasn't funny to begin with, and then it'd be like, they're so terrifying that this weirdo who loves McDonald's killed himself over it, didn't help me think it was funny. It was just, like,
it was too ridiculous even for doing
control. Yeah. Delete the butt.
Kind of, I thought it was kind of mocking Trump, like, with the eating
McDonald's, yeah, I think about,
and then, like,
oh,
the Bureau of Normalcy.
Yeah, that's true. I can see that. Like, that aspect of it, but then nothing else about his personality. Like, if the rest of him had been kind of Trumpy, then that would have, you know. But he was just kind of, like, PTSD man. I don't know. It was
well,
very
I mean,
strange.
He has, like, the not normal people locked up in cages, so I guess.
But, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was very deep. Okay. May is very deep.
Way too hard.
May is a butt troll. Anyway. Anyway, I also, like you, I'm very disappointed with, like, that Cyborg is going to have to, like, live with, like, Vic's going to have to live with having, like, accidentally killed his father as well as his mother. I really don't like that. Plus, I really, really like Phil Morris as Silas, and I'd really love to see more of him. So, I think that he should be alive, and I don't care if it has to be, like, a super, you know, crazy method of saving him. Or, like, make a deal with the devil named Mr. Nobody to save him, or whatever. You know, I don't care. And that was actually Mr. Nobody's plan. That's my prediction. But also, like, if they do that, then great. But whatever it is, I really want to keep Phil Morris around. Plus, I think that he's a good, not replacement, but, like, they obviously need some kind of parental or authority figure. Yeah. So he's, like, a good, like, chief stand-in. And so, yeah, so I don't like that. I don't like, yeah, I feel like They're relying too much on the, like, violent side, like, the way that, the cybernetic stuff makes Vic go haywire and then become violent, and then we're not getting to see as much of his personality outside of that. Like, we obviously see that in real time, but with the flashbacks, and whatnot, it just feels, and also the future, right? And every other time, like, oh, Vic might go crazy and kill everyone. Like, I would like to see more of what he was like out before that. What Vic is like.
Yeah.
And those are my dislikes. So, do you guys have predictions? Mm-hmm. Aside from, they're going to make a deal with Mr. Nobody to save Silas.
Right.
I just want to know what Mr. Nobody's plan
is. Silas is not dead. Eric Hughes. I throw it back to the writers and say fix it. But my prediction is... Grid is really freaking me out. fixed his son is actually like alien technology. The father box, which is what we're seeing on Young Justice, by the way. Where Vic, where Silas uses like the alien technology, the father box, to create Cyborg, and then he, the father box has some kind of like connection to Mother Box and like goes off, goes haywire and stuff like that. So I wonder if we'll get like a version of that in Doom Patrol, in which Grid is actually alien technology, and that's why it seems to have like a mind of its own and seems to be upgrading Vic to 100% Cyborg without his permission. And I also think, because I know like in the beginning of before the show started, when you saw like the character designs for all the characters, and everyone was like, why does Vic look like that? Because he doesn't look like full on Cyborg that we see in the comics. So I'm wondering if part of this storyline with Grid continuing to upload Vic's body to cybernetics, you'll get that the other half of Cyborg's face like coming into play and being replaced with like machinery. So maybe by the time the season is through, he'll be like 80% Cyborg, and then he'll be like the comics version that we're using.
That's a good prediction.
Yeah.
I got nothing.
The cat ate your homework?
I did. If my non-existent cat.
Project Cat went over to your house. Ate your
homework. It would do that.
Project Cat is a cat from Captain Marvel. Just like trotting over. Yeah.
Lenny is actually my cat. My cat is basically Goose. Goose is what it's called, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, how about a lady with gumption from our three shows?
Rita.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rita for Doom Patrol.
I would actually say Nora for The Flash.
Who
for The Flash? Nora, yes.
Yes. And Legends?
No.
Not this week, Legends.
So, Rita versus Nora versus Rita.
Yep.
I don't know how you beat Mia this week.
That's true.
Yeah.
I would definitely vote Rita off the island. She was great this week, but Nora and Mia did a lot more.
Like, I feel like if Silas told her that she wasn't a linchpin, Rita wouldn't die.
Yeah.
She needed information. So, yeah, between Mia and Nora, but I still don't. Because I still feel like Nora's plan was just, it relied a lot on being super dramatic and excessive. And I just don't see how you beat, like, Mia's inspirational.
Yeah. I think that, like, Mia was the one pushing others this week, whereas Nora was still acting on Amber's plan, so.
Yes.
That's fair.
Yeah. So, Mia!
Sorry, Nora.
That was the closest she's come. She was a pretty active this week.
Yeah, she was. All right. So, you can find us at DCTV Gumption on Twitter. You can email us at ladieswgumption@gmail.com or visit us on ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. And please check out our podcast wherever you check out podcasts. Thank you, and we'll see you again next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.